again, friends. And you are my friends, and welcome to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast, the only podcast on Turner Time, the mothership. I am your host, the great Brian Last, and with me as always, number one Sliphouse boy, Denim David Bixenspan. Bix, how you doing today?
I'm doing well, and I'm glad that you did the full intro, too, because I've been missing that. You've been leaving out one thing or the other here and there, and
You gotta mix it up,
but I like the whole thing. I like your enthusiasm when you do the whole thing.
Well, you were my first fan, so that does mean a lot coming from you. And we are joined by a very special guest again today.
I thought that was Bob Barnett.
maybe. Our special guest today, you may know him as a former belt maker and, I guess, commissioner and referee of the KWA, the Kentucky Wrestling Alliance, Mr. Jim Cornette.
Actually, it was the Kentuckiana Wrestling Association.
Oh, okay.
We were bigger. We were bigger. Well, because Bolin tries to remember. You know, we should tell your listeners that when Bolin and I were young people, the belts that the fans have now are nicer than the belts the boys used. It was Southern Champion or Georgia Champion or whatever the fuck. They were all beat up and fucking wore out. Promoters too cheap to get new ones, but the belts now are wonderful. But they didn't sell belt replicas in the 70s. You had to make your own. So I was more industrious even then than Kenny Bolin. And I would get the cardboard and the aluminum foil and the colored construction paper and the leather, you know, and I would make the championship belts. And then and there's probably Bolin now calling on my phone. I swear to God, it's Kenny Bolin right now. Hey. You dick, I'm on the 605 The Super Podcast right now on Skype when you're calling my phone because I'm trying to tell about some of the first times that you ever cheated and lied to me. So I'll call you back later. All right, anyway.
Did you even give him time to say okay, or did you just hang up on him?
No, I just hung up on him.
Okay.
So I would make these belts and these nice, you know, replica championship as much as those materials can be nice. And then Bolin and I would have matches for him. And of course, even then he wouldn't put anybody over, so he always had to win. And I was trying to get the match in the ring because I was a future promoter. So I'd agree to do the job, but he'd win the belt, but then he never took care of the belts. All the belts all disappeared. If we had those belts now, we could both make a fortune selling those belts on eBay.
I'd love to see what one of them looked like.
They were amazing things.
What but did you I, get them from?
You get one of those big, thick leather belts that they used to have to hold jeans up and everything, and then you take cardboard and make the plates, and then you wrap them in aluminum foil, and the colored construction paper aids in the thing, and then, of course, you take the Sharpie for the writing, and they were and sometimes even hanging little dog chains from one plate to another just to give it that extra pomp and magistry is what I'm trying to say.
Was that your brass knuckles title, the one that had the chain?
We didn't have a brass knuckles title. No, because the territory was not big enough to support more than one title because there was only four of us wrestling at any given point in the whole fucking thing. So even then we knew we shouldn't just throw out and pollute the whole territory with championships. It would dilute the importance. We drew over 12 people to the Oldham County High School gym locker room on the wrestling mats down there because Adrian Reynolds, who got killed by the Louisville police force, not at this time, though, not for doing this. Adrian Reynolds was one of the trainers and had the key to the locker room. So on weekends, we would have our matches. And generally, it was usually girlfriends and or little brothers. But we drew over 12 people for a climactic match between me and Bolin one time, which saw me do the Randy Savage elbow drop off of the side pads that went up about 4 feet that we used as turnbuckles on the wall and missed that. And then Bolin pulled out a chain and clocked me in the head like Lawler had on Memphis Wrestling that same morning and pinned me for the belt.
Now, which was better, your Kentuckiana Wrestling Alliance or Mike Sample's Kentuckiana Championship Wrestling?
No, actually, we had more experienced workers because we had actually watched wrestling on television before. And also we drew bigger crowds because did I mention we drew over 12 people at one Saturday afternoon?
Well, that's definitely something we're going to talk about a little further coming up. But I do want to say for all of our regular listeners, the usual follow-ups will be next week on the show because we have a very special guest. We're going to do our usual section of follow-ups next week on the show, but we will do the top 10. Of course, Jim, this is the first time you've experienced our top 10. It is voted on by our listeners at facebook.com/superpodcast. It is a top 10 of favorite cult favorites, favorite characters we've talked about on the show, favorite failures and frauds, anyone involved in the underbelly of professional wrestling.
It's our super universe.
It's the 605 super universe. And
I thought if it was just devoted to failures and frauds, perhaps you could call it the Ronnie P. Gossett Memorial Award.
Well, number 10 on the list this week is fake Stan Lane, someone you almost knew.
Jesus.
Fake Stan Lane, of course, selling fake Stan Lane gimmicks at his funeral. Well, someone sold them at his funeral. It wasn't him.
Was it the wife or the sibling?
It finally came out that the siblings had known that he was as full of shit as a Christmas turkey since they'd heard the story. But the wife actually it came as a surprise to her, and they didn't want to pop her bubble while he was alive and say, no, this fucking guy's bullshit. And I guess apparently that was the best she could do. I don't know. They didn't want to rock the boat. So the wife was the one that was convinced that he was really Stan Lane.
But where did the selling gimmicks at the funeral come in?
I don't know whether – and I think that has maybe become an urban legend. They had Fabulous One's gimmicks laid out as part of the display, but I'm not actually sure that people were – that money was changing hands.
I'm kind of hoping they buried him in a top hat and a bow tie
in the tailcoat. Yeah.
They played the Gap Band as they dropped him into the ground.
You dropped a body on me, baby.
And of course, Stan Lane is the only wrestler who was trained by Rick Ratchet.
Listen to Bick stealing my jokes. Well, that's number 10. Number 9, misnomer Chris Adams. Now, this came up, Jim, when we had Mark Galeen of the House Galeen on the show a few weeks ago, and he mentioned that Chris Adams was no gentleman. That's quite the misnomer. So misnomer Chris Adams is number 8. Do you have any Chris Adams stories?
Very few. We were there during the time that Chris and Gino were there, but they ran with each other. We certainly didn't go to the same night spots. And he was a quiet – I couldn't believe what happened to him because Chris was a quiet guy, at least as far as being a – he didn't come in the goddamn room like Brody, you know, in the locker room or, you know, some wild man. He was not at that point, I thought, any time unprofessional or didn't show up in no condition to perform, but was always polite to people. He got run off for that week by Billy Jack. You heard about that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, tell the story for our listeners who haven't heard it.
Well, of course, you've heard every fucking story. You goddamn, you're a savant of some description. Idiot usually comes in front of that, so I guess I ought to stay away from that. But anyway, Jeannie, Lady Blossom, Jeannie Clark, was originally from England and then moved to Portland because she had known Chris Adams, apparently, because the English connection, but then went with Billy Jack in Portland. Well, and apparently there was heat over this. And then when they booked Billy Jack to replace Carrie while Carrie was supposed to be shooting a movie and was not going to be available to wrestle, they brought in Billy Jack as this big baby face to take his spot. And the first week they booked Billy Jack, first night in the territory, against Chris Adams for the TV title. Chris Adams apparently left town and didn't show up for the match or for several days afterwards until he was assured that he was not going to be booked against Billy Jack Haynes. So there was that, you know, that issue. And then, of course, Jeannie later on became famous for being Jeannie Clark, I guess, Jeannie Austin. But anyway, where were we going with this?
No, wait. What movie was Carrie doing?
Oh, he didn't get the part. That's why they fucking Billy Jackson fucking he quit and went back to Portland.
What was he auditioning for, though?
Return of the Jedi.
Some fucking movie. I don't fucking know. It wasn't my week to watch him. But yeah, and that's why Rip Oliver, because Rip Oliver came down as a heel with Billy Jack because they liked to work together to get him over and do this big program and be a top guy. And all of a sudden they were fucking Jack and Rip around and they gave him to me to manage. And we were all in the middle. So he said, fuck it, and got suspended for hurting Mike Von Erich in Fort Worth and went back to Portland and never came back.
And of course, Jeannie Clark just put out a book. So hopefully we'll have a review of that sometime in the future. It should be a very interesting read. But that's number 9 on the list. Number 8, he's got chains, he's got charms. Santo Gold is number 8. And we are still working on trying to get someone who is involved with Blood Circus on the show. It's tougher than you would think. And a few of our listeners
Most people apparently don't want to admit it.
Well, apparently, Jim, the movie was screened 3 times, and one of the screenings had a total audience of 3 people, including 2 extras and one of the people who worked on the film. It's like this legend, this film. So we need to we're trying to find a way to see it or at least find that information about it. Number 7 on the list, from the House of Galeen, Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage.
Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage.
Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage, the mysterious
Yo
man.
Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage.
Oh, I thought you were going to stop.
Oh, no, I was talking. We're still trying to find out any information. We had a lead. We thought it may have been Ben Peacock, the Botswana Beast, and Dave Prazak, friend of the show, said that he had Ben Peacock's old phone number. And then we got some news, Bix. What was that?
That Ben Peacock has been dead for anywhere from 5 to 15 years.
Oh, yeah. No, I knew that. I remember hearing it's been forever when I heard that he was dead.
The thing is, it seems like it was never reported anywhere. I asked Meltzer. He didn't remember ever hearing about it. And I don't think All Japan ever did like a in-ring ceremony for him that they do for all of the former All Japan guys who have passed away. So
Yo Mamba was only on the one show, right?
That we could find a record of, yes.
Him and Tejo Khan against the Midnight Rockers at the Mid-South Coliseum, yes.
And he was not on TV?
Never.
And this was what year?
87.
It was the end of 87.
It is possible, because they used to do what they called the Jackson tape, which was for WBBJ Channel 7 in Jackson, as I recall, and what was it, WTVA, or whatever, Channel 9 down in Tupelo. The B Show. Since they got the Memphis TV also, what they would do is they would shoot the underneath matches in the Coliseum every Monday night, and Lance or Randy Hales or whoever would call the matches live as they happened, and they would put that together for the B Show. So the only way that this motherfucker would have been on television then is if he was on the B Show, tapes of which are scarcer than hen's teeth. And I don't have any from that era because I have minor earlier when I was actually here, I'd moved on to other territories. So this riddle may never be answered.
We will never give up. We will never give up.
Yeah, with that B Show, I mean,
it will never be over until your tapes are broken and bleed. It will never be over.
Yeah, that B Show, I've never seen anything from past like mid 87. And it lasted until like late 88, I think.
Well, see, there you go.
Well, there we go. Well, we're still on the case, folks. Number 6 in the top 10. The Hangman, Bruce Pobanz, former NWA World Champion, body slammed Andre the Giant, multiple-time NWA Champion, I believe, Bix, and he was also in multiple Hall of Fames. The Hangman, Bruce Pobanz.
Well,
did you ever run into this guy, Jim? Good. Did you ever meet him anywhere?
No. That's why I loved the story so much, because I had never run into his I've run into people of his ilk, but never run into him.
Bix, what were you going to say?
What were you going to say?
I don't think he's in multiple halls of fame. I think he just says he's a pro wrestling Hall of Famer because he's in the Hall of Fame.
No.
Oh, it is multiple halls of fame?
He claims he's in multiple Hall of Fames, and the only one we've been able to find any record of is the Jimmy Valiant Boogie Woogie Hall of Fame for people that were trained by Jimmy Valiant.
Oh, Jesus. Well, there you go.
Well, it's
if he went through that camp, he had to be one of the tough ones. I did take a picture last year at LexCon, the Lexington Comic and Toy Convention, with the world-famous spoiler, gentleman, gentleman came up to me. He was about 5 feet six, about 150 pounds, about 65 years old, with visible dandruff from 10 feet away to those of us that are even nearsighted. And he asked if he could take a picture with me because his large 300-pound 20-year-old African-American girlfriend had the camera there, and he said, but wait, hold on, before he took the picture, wait. And he goes in his fanny pack, because that's why I knew he's one of the boys, and he pulls out this mask that looked like one of those Dick Byer destroyer masks that he'd bought in the 70s and worn every day without washing, and put it on and said, people would expect this, can't let the fans see me without my mask. I said, who are you? He said, well, I was the world famous spoiler, but I've been retired for about 10 years. I did it for 20 years. Well, that means he's, from the looks of him, he started when he was 40. And so, you know, sometimes you meet these lost characters in wrestling history that just don't get remembered like they should.
I don't know who I like better as a possible candidate for our top 10. Either the bogus spoiler or zombie Don Jardine. I feel like that may be a better candidate. Maybe this is Don Jardine and he shrunk, you know, in his death because he's been dead for a number of years now. Yeah,
that would tend to shrivel you up, wouldn't it? Yeah. Dying and such.
Do you happen to remember this fella's name? Because years ago, I actually traded DVDs with one of the fake spoilers that worked in Memphis.
No, this guy never worked in Memphis. I'll guarantee you that.
He was a TV job guy who worked against
I don't care. I don't care.
And even this guy, he sent me, like, when he sent me the DVDs, there was an 8x10 photo that he sent, which is him in his spoiler outfit wearing his, like, 1987 CWA Rookie of the Year title belt that he had made.
That he had made. Exactly.
I mean, I would think he had made.
Yeah, no, I guarantee you, Jerry Jarrett did not pay to have a 1987 Rookie of the Year title belt made. He barely would pay to have a Southern Heavyweight title belt made.
Plus, if there was a 1987 CWA Rookie of the Year, it obviously would have gone to Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage.
The Jungle Savage, yes.
That's right. Well, that was number six, Hangman Bruce Pobanz. Number five, the very popular, and we'll have some follow-ups next week, Sue the Shooter. Now, Jim, you don't know about Sue the Shooter.
Who is Sue the Shooter?
Well, her real name was Sue Shooter, and in reading her story, she became, I think Bix actually named her, Sue the Shooter. She was the subject of the article we read on the air, Confessions of a Ring Rat, where she talked about her years being a rat for Jim Barnett's World Championship Wrestling in Australia. And besides the wrestlers that she liked, including Jerry Briscoe, and, well, I guess she didn't like Mark Lewin, she loved Moondog Spot, said he was the best lover she ever had.
What?
But she had a particular love for the midgets, including especially
Wee Willie Wilson from Florida. He was very well hung.
So, were you ever around Wee Willie Wilson?
I saw Wee Willie Wilson worked. Wee Willie Wilson worked. sound like Baba Wawa. Wee Willie Wilson worked in the mid and late 70s, as I recall, and I probably saw him as a fan a few times, but I don't know that I ever met the wee little fellow.
Jim, I'd love to see you with your tennis racket. One of my other favorite midgets had a funny name. Although his name was Sky Low Low, his balls hung high.
Anyway, that's number five, Sue the Shooter.
Every time you do that voice, you put me in mind of Margaret Rutherford in a Miss Marple mystery. I'm just telling you.
I could do Sue the Shooter all day.
I can't get that poor gray-haired old lady out of my mind whenever.
Well, that was number five. She's been number five on the top 10 for a while, so it'll be interesting to see if she goes up or down.
She's gone down many times, but she was always described as a five to me, nevertheless.
Well, number four, making his debut on our list after last week's show, and we'll have more about him next week, is Wrestling Glenn Goza, author of the hit song Wrestling, as well as Heaven Needed a Champion. Jim, was this guy around at all when you were in World Class?
Oh, he was the guy that wrote the song about David Von Erich and et cetera, right?
Yes.
Wasn't he the chaplain or somehow connected with their church, or was he the guy that they named official world-class chaplain, or was that somebody else?
I think that was someone else.
But you know, Fritz was big in the local religious racket as well as in the wrestling racket. See, he bridged the one world that's almost completely fake into the other world that is completely fake. I don't know. It was, you know, once again, that was one of those. I think it had already come out before we got there. So I knew that it had been done, but I wasn't in on the recording. I didn't produce it. I didn't do a Phil Spector and fucking, you know, go in the studio with it.
No wall of sound.
Reverend Gary Holder was the chat.
Reverend Gary Holder, of course. How could I forget? I haven't thought of him in 30 years. That's probably one reason.
The official chaplain of world-class championship wrestling.
Yeah, like here comes Bruiser Brody swinging a chain ready to bash a fucking Abdullah the Butcher's head in. The guy's going to take a razor blade and slice himself from asshole to appetite and bleed all over ringside. Pray for us, wouldn't you, Father?
Well, here's a question for you. When you were in world-class, were there any, like, restrictions that weren't on other territories because they had TV that was syndicated via a Christian network?
No. When we got there, the difference in the style from Mid-South was the finishes were simpler, which some of the heels that were there told us that primarily they thought it was because it was easier for the boys to remember. But they had kept, I mean, Watts had these intricate Eddie Graham style finishes that were designed to leave, you know, little tidbits of points for the future and bring the people back next week for the rematch and further the story and the conflict between these two guys and such and get other people involved in an intricate web. And, you know, their idea at Dallas of a fuck finish when we got there was, okay, fucking Bobby Fulton, you go to pick fucking Condrey up for a slam and Eaton, you fucking hit him from behind and he'll fall on top of him. That was the fucking fuck finish. So it was simpler and they didn't rely as much on legitimate athletes like what's like football players or ex-amateur wrestlers. But as far as violence went, I mean, they didn't have probably as much blood as Mid-South, but I think once again, that was more the style. There was blood when they needed blood. And especially, you know, when Brody and those guys were in the territory. So we didn't at the time, nobody used adult language. And nobody was stripping women and nobody was beating any women up because you knew already not to do that. You couldn't get away with shit like that in society. So, except if it was the heel girl and she got her comeuppance in the end. So really there weren't a lot of restrictions. Wrestling TV didn't have to do outrageous bullshit back then to get, you know, and also I think they thought cause they had a world-class chaplain that they were on the side of the good guys. I don't know.
I don't know. Did he ever appear on TV? The world-class chaplain?
I think they had him at ringside introduced a couple of times, like at you know, at the stadium show or maybe at Reunion Arena or whatever. He wasn't hanging out with us in the locker room on fucking Friday night's Sportatorium, I'll tell you that, or elsewise he'd probably had to pray a lot of extra.
What does a wrestling promotion's official chaplain actually do?
Nothing.
In theory, not in practice.
I guess he blesses the show. I don't fucking know. Fritz just wanted to show that the family was very religious as well as being all American and wholesome, to further, you know, the fact that they were the kings of Texas.
Well, number four, Glenn Goza. Number three on the top 10, the least favorite character in the Super Universe for David Vixenspan.
That's not true.
That is none other than the Black Scorpion.
Bix. Bix. Introduce me to Jim.
Hi, Jim. This is the Black Scorpion.
Jim. Remember when they broke up the booking committee and this was the best idea that came up next?
I just can't believe that Bix, that this fearsome, feared individual, famous individual in professional wrestling, you gave just a cursory introduction to. Hi, Jim. Here's the Black Scorpion. You should have built it up. You should have, Jim, the most feared man, the most dark secret that has ever been perpetrated on wrestling. Something like that.
Jim. Is it a dark secret, a road agent in WWE?
Jim, remember Chattanooga, 1983. It was a birthday party.
It wasn't even my dog. It was Ronnie West's dog. I'm innocent only.
You know what? Before we go any further.
Some people, by the way, have exaggerated that story to where he actually closed the territory down because we did a birthday party for the dog on TV and not just because it happened to be the last week that we did.
You know, you said something recently, I forget how it came up, but me and Bix were talking about it. The hat that you wore during that time.
Yes.
Where did you get it, and what was the story behind getting it?
Caulfield's Novelties is a costume shop here. It's been here in Louisville for ages and eons. Went down. I used to get my Halloween shit there when I was a kid. Went down there and remember they at the time had those cool in the 60s. They had those cool over the head latex Frankenstein and Dracula masks and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Famous monsters. It was really cool. Not just the, you know, strap on shit with a rubber band. But anyway, I went down there and there were these yachting hats, and at that time they were like $3 a piece. And you know, they were cheap things, but they had the shiny bill and the little crest on it, and they were stuffed with just like paper, just paper around the rim to get to make it stand up, right? So I'd get a bunch of those because after you'd go out there and sweat for 20 minutes, the fucking paper would be either so soggy and so wet that it was coming apart in pieces, and you'd have to restuff it like every night with new paper. Or as the first time that I wore it in the Coliseum, the fucking paper trailed out. It looked like toilet paper hanging out of my ass, except it was a 3-foot thing of paper hanging out the back of my hat. It looked like it was in a French Foreign Legion with the tail down the back or whatever. And I'm swinging my hat around and I put it back on and it just goes. So the gimmick didn't last the test of time.
Was there a reason you didn't try to do the poodle thing anywhere else?
That was Ronnie West's dog, as I mentioned. We did basically, Watts wasn't going to go for a birthday party for the dog. He went with the cake party celebrating us winning the Mid-South Tag Team Championship. I don't know whether Dundee pitched the birthday party for the dog, but we got the fucking, you know, the party and the cake anyway. Well, then the next time I did it was in, Dusty had seen obviously that, where it was a party for winning the belts or whatever. So then he made it a party for us holding the United States Tag Team Championship for 1 year or whatever the fuck. And Fantastics fucking did it. So the poor puppy didn't come up. Also, I wasn't going to take any of my dogs out there in front of those heathens. And the fans too.
Did you have a dog at that time?
In the 80s, I would have had my little Westies, Snuffles and Muffy.
Okay, I thought that was the names of the Rock and Roll Express that you...
No, that was Muffy and Sissy.
That's right. Well, that was number 3 on the top 10. Number 2, Orgasmic Larry Nelson. Now, do you know the story? Actually, I'm sure you don't, so let me tell you, Jim. Larry Nelson, someone we've become.
Why don't you just tell me the movie you'd like to see?
Larry Nelson has become very popular here on this show, and we're working on a segment about him in the future.
Well, this would be the first one then, as far as I know.
One of the reasons he's become popular is there are a series of interviews he did that borderline on absolutely absurd, yet are incredibly entertaining, because in either a cocaine-induced stupor or just his overall general enthusiasm, he reacts in a way that no other wrestling commentator has ever reacted before.
I remember seeing some of those when he'd just get all just positively giddy and just put his fists up in the air in a shaking manner and just beam.
Well, the interview we played on the show was an interview that he conducted with Derek Dukes, an African-American wrestler from late 88 or early 89.
And 89, I believe.
Early 89.
I got a story for you about Derek Dukes in a minute, but go ahead.
So he's talking about Derek Dukes' upcoming match with Colonel DeBeers. And Derek Dukes is just completely nonplussed. It's quite humorous just because he doesn't care what's going on. And Larry's very invested in this interview. And Larry explains that Colonel DeBeers has a stipulation that he wants for their upcoming match.
What's the stipulation?
And the stipulation that Colonel DeBeers is asking for is that if he beats Derek Dukes, Derek Dukes will be painted white.
Oh, Jesus Christ. What year did they?
89. 89.
And there's a lot of difference between Minnesota TV in 1989 and Birmingham TV in 1971. I don't know that they could have still.
Okay. Think about the stories we've heard about Vern, though.
Well, all right. Well, there you go.
Derek Dukes' response is that he will gladly accept that match as long as Colonel DeBeers accepts his stipulation.
What's the stipulation?
And his stipulation was that if he defeats Colonel DeBeers, he would paint Colonel DeBeers black. And Larry Nelson is so overjoyed by the idea that this is his reaction on the air.
Well, first he says, paint Colonel DeBeers black, and then...
No,
hence orgasmic. Play the orgasm one more time, Bix.
What?
No.
That was Larry Nelson's response to hearing about this stipulation. Oh. He also jumps up and down while
yeah. And he was a large, fleshy man anyway, right? So
sort of like a dirty Santa.
Jumping up and down. With, you know the story about Derek Dukes and Mark Gastineau, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Have you told it on the show? Would your viewers like to hear it?
I think we've mentioned it briefly, but go ahead.
Well, thank you, Bix. I'll just fucking bore everybody with it. No. They wanted to run Gastineau's record up. The former football player, and he became a boxer. And his managers and agent, whoever the fuck owned him, they wanted to run his record up. So they arranged for him to have a couple of fucking fights with tomato cans or setups in out-of-the-way fucking places. One of them, and the reason I know is because Sandy Scott told me the story. He knew the manager. He lived in Roanoke. And Salem, Virginia is right outside Roanoke. That's where they had the fight at Salem Civic Center, an old wrestling building. And basically, this was the late 80s, and it was small-time boxing, so under the radar. There was no fucking press there for this. They deliberately didn't invite anybody or try to get publicity for Mark Gastineau fighting, except locally, try to get some people in the building. But there was no internet, blah, blah, blah. So they got Derek Dukes, who not only was wrestling for Vern at the time, but had boxed like two or three times professionally or whatever, enough to have a record and be in the book. So if you beat this fucking guy, it counted, right? So the fucking fight happens, and apparently on the knockout shot, whatever they'd called, when fucking Dukes forgot what sport he was in, and when he got hit with the shot, he took a big flat back bump, threw his feet up in the air, and bam. And the way they had goddamn that got publicity was an Associated Press or some sports writer from one of the wire services happened to be in town visiting his grandmother or whatever and went to the fight and then sat at the airport the next morning and waited to see Derek Dukes and tried to interview him. And Derek's like, hey, man, I just, you know, whatever the fuck. And blew him off, got on a plane, and they wrote the story. And it killed Gastineau's boxing career because suddenly they found out boxing was a work. Imagine that.
If anyone wants to get all of the details on the Gastineau thing and the other adventures with, what was the name of the promoter? Like something like Rick Elvis Parker was his manager.
Oh, God, yeah.
Rob Russin has a book that's on Amazon. I forget what it's called, but if you look up Rob Russin, Rob, and then last name is Russin, R-U-S-S-E-N. Yeah, he promoted his IWA promotion for years, worked for Vern booking spot shows. He was involved in all of that, and I forget the name of it's not the name of the book, but if you look up his name, you'll find it. So if you want to check that out, I think it's on Kindle and hard copy too. Use our Amazon link, which of course is tinyurl.com/605Amazon, or if you're in the UK, /605AmazonUK, or Canada, /605AmazonCA.
Okay,
now,
well.
Shouldn't we have said, fans, get your pencil and paper and get ready to write down the address we're going to give you to write in for the free pictures of your favorite wrestlers before you gave all that information out? How do you expect anybody to remember that?
They press the thing on the podcast thing where it goes back 10 seconds.
Oh, there's a thing you can do that?
Yeah.
Ah.
Anyway, that was number two, orgasmic Larry Nelson. Number one on the top 10, the biggest debut in the history of the top 10, disappointed Lance Russell. The Lance Russell that is disappointed that the heels acted like heels. The Lance Russell that is disappointed when a babyface lies to him and turns heel. Let's say attacks Tommy Rich when the camera's not on him. Disappointed Lance Russell. The highest debut in the history of the top 10, debuting at number one.
So I guess you're shedding the title.
you can't get any better. You can't go any further. Debuting at number one. And Jerry, now I've made excuses for you. And a lot of your friends have made excuses for you, but Jerry, the thing you're just you're a darned egomaniac, Jerry, is what and
well, that's our top 10. And then in our championship match, again voted by the listeners at facebook.com/superpodcast, it was Mark Galeen of the House of Galeen defending his title and defeating Denim Fritz Von Erich. The very popular, growing in popularity, leaps and bounds every day, Denim Fritz Von Erich. So next week, it's disappointed. I was about to say disgruntled. Disappointed Lance Russell against Mark Galeen. You can vote on that starting Thursday afternoon. Now, before we go any further, Denim Fritz, I did this last week. I'm going to do it again. Whoever commandeered the Denim Fritz Twitter page has been tweeting out some funny, funny shit. So I'm going to read a couple of these in my Denim Fritz voice.
Well, first, should we explain Denim Fritz to Jim?
No, you should let me talk. And if I'm going to start by.
Touche.
I'm going to start by reading.
No, by the way, hold on. Let me just say, Bix, I'm up on this. Who in the world now doesn't know that Denim Fritz Von Erich has now taken over Twitter after putting 468,000 people into Texas Stadium and all the things that he's done down in Texas?
Oh, I didn't realize you were following Denim Fritz.
Exactly.
Well, everybody is.
So I'm going to start by reading my favorite one again from last week because it cracked me up so much. Nothing worse than sitting down to watch Matlock and getting a call that Bronco locked himself in his own car again. I just blocked Lance Storm, guy running around claiming to be a wrestler. Looked like an overblown gymnast in a slap fight. I keep hearing...
Ouch.
I keep hearing about Young Bucks. Me and my boy shot a couple last fall. The heads are on my office wall. This one may be my favorite of this week. Another match added for our Cotton Bowl extravaganza. Killer Tim Brooks versus Brian Adias in a fans run for the concession stand match.
That was Brian Adias' gimmick they gave him every while, wasn't it?
I bring Brickhouse Brown into my territory, and now the hubcaps on my Eldorado are missing. Gino loaned me some of his sugar for my coffee. In a totally unrelated note, I haven't slept in 4 days. And one more. I'll give one more. Let's see. I'm thinking about booking an intergender match. Sean Simpson versus Jeep Swenson. I still got the touch. So those are our weekly picks from the Denim Fritz Twitter account. Whoever you are doing it, you're very funny, and I give you a lot of credit.
I thought it was Fritz.
No, well, there were two Denim Fritzes on Twitter, and they like, battled it out, and this guy won the battle, so he's now the official Denim Fritz.
The official.
And I got to say, you guys out there, I know a bunch of you have started these Twitter accounts. There is now a Twitter page for the Black Scorpion, Yo Mamba the Jungle Savage, Dark Journey's Dog, Fake Stan Lane, Denim Fritz Von Erich, Orgasmic Larry Nelson. I saw one for Robert Gibson's Eye. We have not even talked about that on the show, but he's been in a feud with Fake Stan Lane on Twitter. That's been pretty hysterical. You guys are awesome. We always say this. You listeners make this show what it is. So thank you.
So it's their fault. You accept no responsibility.
Absolutely.
It's on them.
Deflect. Deflect is the magic word. But now that we're past the top 10, Jim, I want to talk to you, and Bix wants to talk to you about various topics. I want to start with something I watched the other day. I hadn't seen this in forever, and it was more brutal to me than ever before. Maybe the most brutal incident in the history of the wrestling business. Of course, I'm talking about when you had your head shaved in the summer of 1984. Oh,
Jesus Christ.
I never noticed before the moment in your eyes when you see, I'm guessing, Bobby Fulton come into the ring with the Bic razor, and you actually say, fuck you, Bobby. Like, right.
Yes, fuck you, Bobby. I'm leaving, guys.
First of all, I want to know what's going through your head during this whole thing, but who came to you and said, we're going to do this? And did you have any say, or was it you're losing your hair?
Well, it was, you're losing your hair, you're losing your job. No, it was like, do this, you know, look what we've done for you, pal. No, Vince should have delivered this, but it was Dundee. They wanted to revitalize New Orleans. After Dog had left, business everywhere else was great, but New Orleans weekly was still the shits. The dome shows would come up, whatever the fuck, but... So they decided to do that for whatever reason. and turn Dr. Death at the same time as part of the angle, shave my head to make them happy there, but Doc got some heat, blah, blah, blah. It was with Hercules, Hernandez, and Duggan. And so anyway, I said, okay, I'll get these fucking clippers. I got the goddamn clippers. I said, not slick. Give me the fucking crew cut. I'll go for the crew cut. Here, we put the fucking gimmicks on. Well, I used to have a lot of hair back then. And in the middle of New Orleans at that, and it was 100 degrees and 100% humidity. By the time the match was finished, my hair was thick and soaking wet. So the trimmers are just bogging down. These aren't barbers. It's goddamn, who was it? Duggan was trying, Terry Taylor was holding me. Bobby Fulton, Tommy Rogers holding me. Duggan's trying to shave the fucking head. These fucking, we should have got plug-in power trimmers. I guess they're better, but this battery operated shit wouldn't work. He's pulling it out by the roots. I'm a motherfucker. Well, then they say, go get some fucking scissors. Well, somebody comes back with a goddamn set of like manicure scissors from their little shaving kit and broke those trying to cut, and they're gouging holes in my head. And here comes Bobby Fulton finally with a thing of shaving cream and a big disposable razor to shave my thick, wet fucking, they've got runways and strips where it looked like I'd had chemotherapy. Pieces were falling out. I had a bald strip up one side, but it was long on the other side. It was, I had to, when I got back to the locker room in the hotel that night, I had to take the thing and buzz it all off. Anyway, but they couldn't, we were there for 20 minutes. And I said, I'm leaving, motherfuckers. You're digging my fucking scalp off with that Bic razor. And I fed my foot to the fucking heels and they pulled me out and we departed.
Man, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Wait, it didn't get over very well and it didn't draw that well. But then here's the thing. I lost my hair twice that week. Because the following Friday night in Houston, they had booked me to put my hair up in another match in Houston, which did drew like 90 grand, as I recall. It was a fucking huge house. Instead of saving it for then and shaving my head there, they flew in Jesus Christ, my cousin Percy, Jim Jameson, the job guy from Memphis. And paid him $500, the biggest payoff he ever got in the wrestling business in his life, to be my cousin Percy. And I went out with a fucking mask and said I've flown my cousin Percy Cornette in to put his hair up. And, of course, they shaved his head and pulled my mask off so everybody had to see me with no hair. And fucking that sold out practically. The fucking New Orleans where I actually got fucking shaved and fucked around. I think my payoff was less than fucking Percy got.
Oh, man. How often did Watts make the trip to New Orleans? Was he at every show?
Are you fucking ribbing? I don't remember him being at a show if it wasn't a Superdome.
Really? Okay.
He was not booked to wrestle on anything unless it was the Dome during the last Stampede down in New Orleans. And no, Grizzly was there and his booker was there, which was Dundee. And he was in Bixby, which was 700 fucking miles away. And if maybe he was there a time or two and I just don't recall because I saw him regularly in Shreveport at TV or whatever. But no, as a rule, Watts would never go to New Orleans. He wouldn't go to most of the towns. He would go to Shreveport TV. He would go to Tulsa, obviously, because that's where he was usually probably in. Sometimes he was in Oklahoma City, but often he wasn't. Grizzly, he trusted to keep him informed on what was going on in his business, and his booker carried out his instructions and or reported into him every day. He didn't need to be there. And you knew the specter of the Hoghead, as some people said, the specter of the cowboy hung over you when you were in the building. You knew if you fucked up in any way, he was going to hear about it before you got back home. So it wasn't necessary.
On the topic of Louisiana, let me ask you this, Jim. In person, what is the craziest riot you saw as a fan and as a performer?
I didn't see any as a fan. I was in all of them as a performer. That was pretty much the problem, is they thought they could whip us, and they were usually right, because Dennis and Bobby weren't Nikolai Volkoff, 300 pounds, or Ernie Ladd, 7 feet tall, or fucking Hercules Hernandez, you know, goddamn Greek god or whatever. We were just little fucking twerps. The worst one ever was in Tulsa. where it started, and that's when I was wearing that goddamn mask from getting my head shaved. I think we used my belt, threw my belt in and double clotheslined Bobby Fulton, and that ticked this one guy off, and he came over the fucking rail after me, and I rolled in, and as he was coming into the ring, there came Dennis Condrey from one side, and I kicked from the other side, and we both kicked him in the face. Dennis busted him open, right? And boom, and he goes off the ring. He said, let's get out of here. So we bailed to the floor, and here come the cops, but a guy fucking throws a beer in my face, and now it's dripping, and the mask is soaked, and I can't see. So Bobby's trying to get me through the people, and the cops are hustling us up, and everybody's trying to get a hold of us, so they're taking the nightsticks to people, and so they throw us through, and there's the same fucking guy that started the whole thing. So of course here Dennis has my belt by this point wrapped around his fist. He's taking swings at people, so he fucking pickles the guy is laying there that started the whole thing, laying there with a streak of blood down the wall where the cops have deposited him. And he's not bothering anybody, but Dennis wanted to get a shot. Actually, I went over first and started kicking him. And as I did, the old back door guard came up and said, oh, come on. And he looked like the referee doing a distraction spot. As he backs me up, Dennis comes over and blasts him one time with the fucking belt on his fist. And it was fucking chaos. And that's when they got I wasn't wearing the mask that time. I'm telling a lie. It's in the Midnight Express book, though, because that's when they sent internal affairs down to investigate the police brutality, because so many of these fans, they were stacking them up next to the back door after they hit them with the billy clubs and before they would take them to jail. So the internal affairs came down, investigated. We said, hey, they were trying to protect our lives. The Tulsa City Police Department said that they found a statute or whatever that they could not do security at wrestling matches anymore. And they farmed it out to the county sheriff's department, because we had a Donnybrook, as they say, in Tulsa for the Midnight Express's match about six shows in a row. That was pretty much, that's why I hated to go to Tulsa. If you ever saw me in Tulsa for Mid-South Wrestling at ringside, I would do nothing. if I was called for me to do something in the finish, I would begrudgingly do it to the best of my ability, but otherwise I would stand at the ring post and do absolutely fucking nothing. I wouldn't cheer for anybody. I wouldn't fucking wave my arms. I'd turn around plenty to watch my back, but we had cops up there. But if I did anything, I didn't want to give anybody, because they were coming anyway. I got used to that. So why the fuck am I going to piss them off even further when we're going to have one of these motherfuckers over the rail by the time this is over with? And we did.
What was your impression about how much this happened to other heels, either when you were there or before you were there? Like, how much of it had to do with the Express being smaller guys than had been headlining heels in Mid-South before, combined with, you know, your whole gimmick and everything? Like, in terms of the wrestler end, I guess, more with the Express.
Yeah, did anyone jump on Terry Gordy? You know?
Yes, no, actually, it wasn't unusual. I mean, one night in Shreveport, before we got there, they told a story that Grizzly Smith had to jump off the stage of the Memorial Auditorium, where they used to do the Louisiana Hayride, and Elvis Presley and everybody was on the radio. But he jumped off the stage at 7 feet and 400 pounds to save King Kong Bundy. This little guy jumped on him and was just beating the piss out of him. I saw a guy tackle Hercules Hernandez doing a run in one night, and that's the one that Herc's open hand slapped when he came back through. The cops had him there. The guy stood up and Herc slapped him in the face and lifted him off the ground, and the guy's head hit the concrete wall a foot away and he dropped, and we walked over him to go to the ring for our match. And 20 minutes later, we came back. He was in the same position and the ambulance had just gotten there from an open hand slap. He tackled Hercules trying to do a run-in. One night, Butch Reed was doing a run-in Tulsa in our match. And as he dove in, a fucking guy waist-locked him, tackled him, and was hanging on him. And I had to run down the apron ring, kick the guy in the side of the head a few times to get him to let go. So as I told Butch, you know, he didn't have to thank me for saving his life. But they... a cop, one day, when they brought the sheriff's department in the first night, we were at the fairgrounds in Tulsa, and they've sent the old sheriffs, like the retired ones that were doing this shit for extra money. And the match before ours, a fan has tried to hit Nikolai Volkov over the head with a steel chair, and has missed and hit the cop and horse collared the cop with a chair, and they brought the cop in with his feet dragging, unconscious, the two of them carrying him. And I was like, they're fucking hitting the cops overhead with chairs. I'm next. What are they going to do to me?
Wow.
So they did it, but they did it more often for us because, honestly, to be truthful with you, we got more heat. And there was an element of, yeah, I think I can whip these fucking guys.
So speaking of heat and riots and all that, something I was thinking about was Ron Wright. In Smoky Mountain, what's the most heat you saw him get as a manager, or the most memorable fan interaction you remember with him, anything like that?
Oh, God. Well, it was a different era at that point, but and still while Smoky Mountain Heels got heat, as a matter of fact, Ken Cantrell is going to send me the tape of that woman in Barberville dragging Tammy by the hair of the head all the way across the Knox Central High School gym floor. Shit.
There's tape awesome. Of that?
Apparently, he's got it, so he's going to send it to me. But I mean, yeah, we had guys come in the ring and things, or women in case of Tammy's case. But Ron got a lot of heat, but nobody, number one, I don't think anybody maybe legitimately ever believed he had to be in the wheelchair. And as such, are you going to fucking tackle Ron Wright with his fucking reputation at that point? And also, you know, can you tackle the guy in the wheelchair, whatever the fuck? He never got anybody over the rail physical at him, but there was the night at the Bluegrass Brawl when he had the Smoky Mountain title match with Tracy after they'd burned the Confederate flag and hurt Tracy and done all that stuff, where Tracy's selling gimmicks at the merch table, and the guy came up and gave him his card from the Klan and said, hey, if you need backup tonight, if you don't have him, we do. And Ron had his fucking pistol underneath his blankie on his lap in the wheelchair just in case. And you know, but thankfully, Tracy won the match. Now, if we'd had a different finish going on, and we might have had an issue, but, it was time to switch the belt.
I think Tracy told me he got sick before that match after he got that card. Is that right?
I think he got sick after the match because it was 172 degrees in there, and they went for like 25 minutes in a double juice chain match. So I think that's why, because I remember he definitely didn't feel too good after the match was over with. Well, and I don't blame him. They just beat the piss out of each other. It was a brutal match.
That's one of my favorite Smoky Mountain shows from top to bottom ever. Because that's also the one with the three-way tag match at the end.
Yes.
And you have Lance Russell.
And Lance Russell and Les Thatcher doing the commentary.
Fantastic show. The first Bluegrass Brawl. Before we move on to other topics and pass Mid-South completely, I do want to ask you one thing, Jim. Bix and I are both part of a private Facebook group that John McAdam runs, which is fantastic. We just talk old wrestling and other things. And one of the people on there, Thomas Bain, had a question recently about exactly what happened that led to you going to World Class. I know you've told this story many times, that you were prepared to go to Crockett. Flair and Dusty had fallen in love with the Midnight Express and you and wanted to bring you guys in. However, Bill Dundee informed you that Watts had made a deal for you guys to go to World Class because him and Fritz were partners at that time in several towns in Oklahoma. And it was the decision was made. It was done. You were going there and you appreciated everything that had happened for you in Mid-South. And you didn't want to say, no, we're going to Charlotte. So you went there. It's been said that you gave your notice on the first night.
You just told the story.
Well, I'm going to ask you because
here's what it was. We went over there because we didn't tell them at first. See, it was news to us. We were told we were finishing. We weren't told we were going anywhere. So naturally, since nobody had really been demanding our services in the past, we figured, well, we better find some place to go. And the invitation had been open from Crockett. So we took it. And then we found out we're booked in goddamn Dallas. Or Fort Worth for TV, for World Class. They want us to go over there. So before we said anything, we thought, well, let's go check this thing out. So we went over, and then basically they weren't even in the regular Will Rogers building, as I recall now. It was one of the cattle barns at the fairgrounds. And we just thought it was such a smaller talent roster. It was a small crowd in a makeshift building that night. So it wasn't exactly the best look at World Class anyway, but also we said, who we got to work with here? If it's not the Von Erichs, we probably ain't gonna make any money. Fantastics, yes, that's great, but that's one. I mean, there was only 14 guys in the territory most of the time. So anyway, we decided we were going to take the Crockett deal, and we gave him, we just told him, look, we got some place to go. We can't stay. And that's the next day when we got home, we heard from Dundee. Watts wants you to go, mate. So we rescinded the notice and we went. And it, as it turned out, we worked with the Fantastics for 6 months, had great matches and a lot of fun, and made underneath money, and never got to work with Von Erichs on top and make the big money, which is why we ended up 6 months later giving our notice. Well, not that we got that $1,100 payoff from Denim for the Texas Stadium.
Did you actually expect to work with the Von Erichs, or did you know right away that wasn't going to happen? And also, what did you think of Ken Mantell as a booker? What was your relationship with him?
Well, Ken Mantell wasn't a booker. He's a babysitter. He maybe in the pantheon of bookers would qualify as a maintenance booker. When somebody else had set something up, like Gary Hart set up the Freebirds and the Von Erich angle, or somebody else had an idea and kind of he formatted it into TV. He was a good maintenance booker, but he was not a creative visionary, nor a finished genius, nor I didn't know what the fuck he was. I didn't understand the program. How can you fuck up a program between the Midnight Express and the Fantastics? Half the time we were battling over a tag team championship that neither of us held because it was held up all the time. It was a fucking mess. So Ken Mantell, booker, as far as, we thought we would work against the Fantastics, and we come in and we win the belts, and we figured we would work with them for a few months and they'd give us some kind of run with the Von Erichs, and then we would evaluate whether we wanted to stay there or not. And we continued to work with Fantastics, continued to work with them. And once again, greatest matches on earth, and it was a paid vacation because we only had to work 5 days a week. And short trips, but the matches with the Von Erichs never came about. And then once again, when we got that fucking payoff for Texas Stadium, $1,150 a piece for, a $250,000 house in the tag team championship match. And that's when we decided, well, we'll resurrect the Charlotte deal and give our notice here as soon as we've done that, which is basically what we did.
How much did working those Fort Worth TV tapings with those long promos help you going forward with your promos?
Oh, that was great, because my first night I said it's a 2 hour show and they only had like four matches on it. And usually a couple of them were two out of three falls. It was brutally fucking boring, except for the interviews, which sometimes also were brutally boring because Mark Lorenz, very nice guy, but it looked like he just stepped off a wedding cake. He was just a statue of tuxedo. And very low key and low tone. So the interviews, if they were not good, your show sucked for half an hour at a time. But anyway, I said, well, how long have I got? And they said, oh, these are open-ended. Just don't let it drag. Okay. So when I came back, they said, okay, can you try to keep it under 7 minutes? And this was back when the average, the big in-ring interviews were 2 and 3 minutes back then. We didn't have these 20 minutes because nobody wrote shit back then, right? But I had to plug the Monday night matches in Fort Worth, the Friday night matches at the Sportatorium in Dallas, the special event, whether it be a reunion arena for Star Wars or Tarrant County Convention Center for the 4th of July or Texas Stadium in May or whatever the case may be. Plus, when they added Rip Oliver, I had to talk about the matches he was going to have that I would, because I was managing him also. So it basically then I had an ongoing bet with the director of whether can you keep it under seven? And most of the time I would try to, but it was tremendous practice because I could do basically anything. I had time to do my fucking material, knocking the people of Texas or Texas icons and celebrities. I've sold the matches. I had to remember them. And then I had to remember if I had a deal going on with Sunshine to get my little shit in there. So it was like, one of those brain teasers or whatever.
One of the things you did in World Class, which I'm sure you're probably not the craziest about being brought up, but you worked with John Harris, who was also known as Little John, Silo Sam. He had many different names. He was someone who for, 3 years or so, was always rumored as going somewhere. He did tryouts for the WWF, and they didn't bring him in, which says a lot because You know, they brought in everyone else who couldn't work, who was a giant, and they didn't bring him in. He had a cup of coffee in Memphis in the AWA. And, of course, maybe the biggest run he ever had, and that's saying something, it was in world class against you. What are your memories of John Harrison? What can you tell us about him?
That's another reason why we fucking quit, because the match at Texas Stadium was Little John was in the corner to offset me against the Fantastics in that fucked up tag title match. If you watch the match back on YouTube or the network or wherever the fuck it is, when you see the camera pan, if they don't edit it, the camera pans to us going to the back. I am cussing. I am hating that fucking match. I was so fucking mad. That's when I decided to quit the territory. I didn't even actually, the boys waited for the fucking checks, but I knew we had to fuck. They found this fucking clown in South Texas somewhere, and Scott Casey, they gave him the task of trying to teach him something or see if they could teach him anything. And Scott reported back that at 7'6", legitimately, I think, and over 400 pounds, most of it in his stomach, that his bench press was like 135. He had no athlete of any kind, didn't know what the fuck he was doing. But they want to do this angle where the Fantastics have found him in South Africa. This is a Ken Mantell fucking explains why he wasn't even on drugs and he came up with this shit. So he missed a hell of an opportunity. He could have been fucked up on everything the boys were doing and not done any worse than this shit. And they found him on a tour in South Africa, even though they hadn't left town for more than 3 days and 6 months. And he was their friend, Little John, and he wanted to get into wrestling, so they wanted to know if he could sit next to me at Texas Stadium to keep an eye on me so I wouldn't interfere, and we'd finally decide who gets these held-up belts. And, of course, that got me the opportunity to get in one of my favorite lines of all time. Little John, sit next to me. Well, sure, where is the wee little fellow as I'm looking around, right? And then, of course, he comes in the side door, and there's this big fucking galoot and overalls and this ridiculous straw hat, this country bumpkin fuck with this giant goiter on his fucking stomach. It looked like a football cut in half with clamp marks where they'd done some kind of operation when he took his shirt off. And we used to make Bobby Eaton throw up because we'd say when he does the belly bump to you, it's going to pop all over you, right? So here comes this fuck into the ring, and he's fucking big as all goddamn Christmas. And I fucking do that, and they replay it in slow-mo going to the bumper, the big eyes and the shock and the heart attack and the fall down, and it was fucking hilarious. And that was the best part of the fucking angle, because when it come time for the fucking match, besides that they wanted him in the – they gimmicked our matchup. We have a chance to have a match in Texas Stadium in front of 25,000 people with the Fantastics, but here are the rules. It can all four men wrestling at the same time. It takes place in both rings because they got two rings set up because they had the first year they had a fucking match and needed a stadium. Second year they had a stadium needed a match. So they've gimmicked it all up. and the match take place in two rings, all four guys same time, one referee in each ring, and Cornette will sit next to Little John, who couldn't say Sue if the hogs had him when it came to wrestling. So already, and no disqualification. So they're just going to have a four-man fight. And they actually had, for those rules, if you go back and watch it, a very exciting fucking match and fight. And it was going great, but Little John had to be involved in the finish. The story was that all he had to do was slap Bobby Eaton's leg and distract him so Bobby could get rolled up while there was a pin in the other ring, and one heel would be up on the pin and one baby face would be up, and both referees count at the same time, but the baby face would get his in a count beforehand. That's what they wanted to do with a goddamn guy that's never been in a fucking ring or in a match before, who's making his debut in Texas Stadium in front of 25,000 people. And they figured, well, you're sitting next to him, just tell him, all right. The match happens. He's supposed to do it. I'm looking at you. Can actually see me on the tape. I'm looking. I'm not screaming at him, but I'm giving him the, do it. Slap his leg. Do it. Do it now. He's standing there. He got lost. He didn't know what the fuck. Bobby's waiting for his leg. Bobby then turns around or whatever the fuck. The point is, because John didn't do something that simple, we actually won the match. The heel pin that Dennis had, the referee counted first, so it plainly wasn't even close. So the people saw us win the belts, then the referee, for no reason, give the belts to the Fantastics, and then we leave the ring. Oh, no, and then here's my big chance to really kill myself. Now that my boys are buried, I'll kill myself too. They wanted me to hit him with the racket and then him not sell it and grab the racket and break it. And I said, he can't break this racket. Well, gimmick it. I said, then if I hit him, I said, then the goddamn thing, it'll break before it's supposed to. Oh no. It just gimmick it a little bit. And it just hit work hitting him. Okay, well, obviously those graphite rackets, it wasn't a metal one, but those graphite rackets were stiff in those days. And it's got to be so he can break it at the same time I can. So I saw it halfway through or whatever, and it still feels pretty stiff to me. So, of course, I run up behind him, and I hit him like poof, a horrible shot with the racket on the back, and the fucking top of the racket just falls off, just like a lollipop. Boom. And he turns around and looks, and I said, well, that fucking figures. And so when I'm leaving the ring, I'm cussing, and I said, boys, we got to go. it was horrible.
I thought the South African thing was a shoot. I thought he actually was South African.
I don't know where the fuck they got him then. The Fantastics didn't run into him in South Africa either, and Andre didn't fucking lift that tree out in front of Carpentier's fucking car, in case you're wondering about that.
I thought that was why he didn't talk, though, was that he had an accent that they didn't want.
I think he didn't talk because he was such a dumb, stupid fuck that he couldn't even speak. I don't know. I remember speaking to him, trying to, because as Gary Hart said, this was where Gary Hart gave me the best piece of advice he ever gave me. When we're going over this over and over and over on the interview and what to do when he came in the ring and over and over and over on the match, Gary said, repetition is the key when dealing with goofs. So we told him over and over and over, and hey, it still didn't do any fucking good. But they actually drew some money with him in Memphis because Eddie Marlin got his pickup truck and put a big bale of hay in it and fucking put Little John Silo Sam or whatever the fuck on the bale of hay and would drive through like the streets of Covington, Tennessee, or his little spot show towns with a sign that says, come see the Giant, $5 tonight, wrestling. That's the way they drew money with him.
Well, for those of you who haven't seen him, we will try to get some clips in this week's video playlist. You may best remember him as being the giant in the movie Pee-wee's Big Adventure, the giant boyfriend chasing Pee-wee all over the place.
Because if you have to watch him wrestle, you're going to have to bleach your fucking eyeballs. I'll tell you that.
You know, you mentioned Gary Hart, Jim. I got to ask you something. I know.
Say, by the way, how long is this fucking show? What is this, a goddamn radiothon? Do we have to give money to get off of here?
Any money would be appreciated. Our donation links are in the post.
We're entering the 90-minute mark. Can Funk and Briscoe go the fucking... No, what was your question?
Well, speaking of Funk, I recently rewatched Terry Funk against Ric Flair, the I Quit match from Troy, New York in 1989. And it got me thinking, you know, obviously Gary Hart's a very important figure in wrestling history for all the things he was involved with in Australia and in Florida and Georgia and everywhere else, world class especially. But by 1989, you know, when the NWA had you and Paul Heyman out there, really active managers who would sell if a babyface hit them. And then all of a sudden you have Gary Hart who won't sell for the NWA champion hitting him. What are you thinking at the time, the fact that Gary Hart's the lead heel manager for the top heels in the company, and he won't do anything to help get the babyface over? For you guys as it is for me watching it?
Hey, Gary was old-fashioned. He came from an era where they didn't get him that much. And if they did get you without letting you do something else, it would take heat off of you. And because he was the size he was, and his gimmick was that he was somewhat of a Chicago badass, he didn't play some of that stuff, you know. And you'd always see him with his hand in his pocket, and there really was a razor blade taped inside the coat. So, you know, but at the same time, yeah, we were starting to get more active. And even though JJ was a bit more lighthearted manager and he took bumps, even though he was of Gary's same generation. But I just think it was a difference in approach. And also, to be honest, Gary couldn't do much physical at that point because of the aftermath of the plane crash, all that stuff that he had broken and et cetera. He wasn't a real, he was not in good shape as far as being mobile to begin with. So I remember one time I was watching a monitor. It was disrespectful, but I was a young pup back then watching Gary do a promo on Atlanta TV in a locker room backstage. And I said, my God, I think Gary just broke a sweat. because yeah, I'd come back looking like I had a bucket of water turned over my head. But it, you know, it was just the difference. It had been very successful for him for a long time. That the style of what he did, and only let him get you in the blow off, and all the pictures that you see of Gary Hart getting the shit kicked out of him, in the, you know, 70s or whatever, were in blow off matches where he was, you know, and also to be quite honest, that's a, he was there at a time we were all on contracts, and he knew, I'm sure as well as I knew, that I was making more money than he was. Cause I'd been there longer, or at least equal to, and I was there longer. So I made more in the long run or whatever, but you know, it, he was used to when they get you, it's going to be where it's the main event match and you're going to get a main event payoff over and above what you normally get to get the shit kicked out of you and et cetera, et cetera. And he was very critical that way with people that would be too giving. He was the opposite, I think, of Flair. People would be too giving sometimes if they weren't getting compensated by the promoter. So
that match is amazing to watch because again, here's the big blow off of the Terry Funk, Ric Flair program. And Flair at some points, because Gary Hart gets involved, will chop Gary Hart or throw punches at him. Gary Hart not only doesn't sell, Tommy Young has to run interference to separate Gary Hart because he's going after Flair.
He didn't want to back down. Yeah, I remember that.
So
and actually, a couple of the times that Flair caught him, see, that's the thing. I mentioned Gary wasn't that mobile. They were fighting so fast and wild around the ring. He got cornered a couple of times and he thought Flair would just go right by him, and Flair tried to go for him. He couldn't get out of the way.
You know, one of my favorite stories from Gary Hart's book is actually about you. He talks about one time you were on a flight together, and I think it was maybe even a time where it was you, him, and David Crockett was on the flight too, when you would have all been in work.
Yes.
Crockett.
Yes.
And how, you know, everyone knows that you have something of a fear of flying or an aversion to flying, however you want to put it.
A mortal terror.
Okay. Fair enough. And how you always felt more comfortable having at least one of them on the plane because you figured, what are the odds this could ever crash? These guys have both been in plane crashes.
Yeah, how many people you know been in two plane crashes? Yeah, that was the theory I was working on. Yes.
When did you find out that Gary had been in two plane crashes?
When I read his book. I always said, Gary, I'm going to sit right next to you. How many motherfuckers I know been in two plane crashes, right? And he never told me. Because it did make me feel better.
Well, we'll talk more about books just in a moment. But before we get to our Book of the Week segment, Jim, one thing we've been talking about here on the show for a few weeks, and I need to talk to you about it. When we had John Arezzi on, John Arezzi gave us information about the early days of Dr. Miglano that we had never heard before, about when he had Miglano stay at his house and kicked him out for stealing his mail and for making sexually inappropriate comments to his young sister. Also, for the time that George Napolitano, one of the nicest guys in wrestling, punched Miglano out. I know you have a few Miglano stories, so I would love, because our listeners have started to have some interest in this crazy fanboy oddity character that is around the outer rims of the professional wrestling business. But what can you tell us about your experiences with Dr. Miglano?
The fanboy oddity, if he ever does an album, actually, that should be. There have been several, but my favorite one is when he got me booked in Japan. When I left WCW at the end of 1990. I was still living in Charlotte. I was home. I was working on Smoky Mountain Wrestling, but hadn't told anybody that. And Leno calls me on the phone. Jim, you know what you ought to do? You're a brilliant booking mind. You should go. At the time, Bix, you can probably help. Well, Brian, you'll probably know the entire history, but they had the Lucha Group, and Victor Quinones, I think, was a part of it, but the Lucha Group was promoting in Japan. What was the name of them?
Universal Lucha Libre with the Grand Hamada.
All together now, Universal and Hamada, yes, and a lot of the luchadors are bringing guys from Mexico. He said, you should go and book that. I'm like, what the fuck, Mike? Number one, I've just gotten off the road with this. I'm wrestling burnt. I'm working on something else. But why would me, a white guy from Kentucky who speaks neither Japanese nor Spanish, go to Japan to book a promotion featuring lucha stars that I have no knowledge of and can't communicate with? And why would they want me to do that? Oh, it would be great. I didn't sound like Trump, right? So I said, well, I nevertheless. So about, I don't know, fucking 4 weeks later, I get an envelope in the mail from Shinma, who was involved with it, right?
Yes. Japan.
And I open it, it says, Mr. Cornette, thank you so much for your communication. You know how the Japanese write. And we would be honored to have you come see our show, our matches, or our tour, or whatever. Maybe you come first tour. In other, now he's pitching, maybe you come first tour, we give you, we trans you, and you come for free to see show, and then they're offering me to fly me over there, but not pay me, because they're probably like, what the fuck, what would he do? But obviously, fucking Leno, goddamn lunatic that he is, huffing the goddamn nitrous, had contacted them, being me. I mean, I remember, I think a story Meltzer told one time. Well, I guess maybe I should. Well, I guess I buried him already. They were roommates together in Japan, and Leno was making some type of way too friendly phone calls to Medusa Michelli long distance overseas all night under his covers in the bed next to Meltzer trying to sleep. I don't know what his fucking deal, but he impersonated me, obviously, to send a letter to Shinma to get me booked, and Shinma's countering with, well, maybe we bring you over and you see, we talk and you see what happens. Like, I'm going to be the booker. And then I had to write him a letter and pay the international postage to fucking send it back to say, there's been some misunderstanding. I did not write you, sir. I wish you good luck with your future business, but I have no interest at this time in coming to Japan.
Did you add PS? If you get any future letters from me that have writing in the margins, it's not me.
Yes, it's not me. If it's scribbled around like a fucking ransom note.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Well, there you go, listeners. Your weekly Dr. Mike Lano anecdote. Before we go any further on the show, it's time for our Book of the Week segment. This week, we're going to do something a little different.
Just so you know, guys, I got a appointment at the top of the hour. I didn't know we were going. I know we have videos we must do.
Well, first, we're going to get to Book of the Week real quick. And
I'm not trying to throw your fucking... I'm not trying to throw your format off.
Listen to this. Jim Cornette comes on a show and starts trying to book the show. Listen, he thinks we're Shinma. Well, Book of the Week, usually we do something to plug the Amazon. But before we do that, we want to talk a little bit about some of the things that you have available on your website, Jim. So why don't we, instead of Book of the Week, instead of Book of the Week, it'll be Merchandise of the Week. So why don't you tell the listeners some of the things you have available right now at JimCornette.com?
I can keep with your theme, because actually the finest piece of merchandise currently on the website, JimCornette.com, Cornette's Collectibles, is, of course, Tuesday night at the Gardens Pro Wrestling in Louisville, the book that Mark James and I have done chronicling the storied history of pro wrestling in Louisville all the way from the 19-teens, when it was a ring in Louisville, Kentucky, where Strangler Lewis first stepped in as Strangler Lewis under that name, all the way through the rise of Jerry the King Lawler in the 70s, and it combines historical research and classic photos and a history of the Louisville Gardens itself that was built 110 years ago, all the way through the different promotions and up to the time that Jerry Jarrett opened up Louisville after a five-year period of being dark to live matches and television, and he put the TV on, and in 6 weeks, he started running the Louisville Gardens, and he did it so successfully, he ran it every weekend or every week for the next 27 years. So it's a fantastic story, and I invite you to avail it. It comes with a complete a free DVD of all of the existing film transfers from matches in the early 70s, during the specific era that the book talks about. You've seen it, Brian. You've seen it, Bix. It's a sight to behold, and it's available at JimCornette.com. That's great. Your Book of the Week.
Great stuff. Everyone, please support Jim, and also let him know that you heard about it here on 605, the Super Podcast. And before we move further, let's just say that...
Give a word they say.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Let's just say that for anything else you want to use, please use our Amazon referral link. It is tinyurl.com/605Amazon. You can go on there. You can buy wrestling books. You can buy any sort of merchandise. It's the same fee, the same price you would pay for anything normally on Amazon. It's just that Bix and I get a little bit of a cut, a little bit of a kickback. It's a way of supporting the show and saying, hey, we think you guys are doing a good job. And you guys know how I feel about this. There are other shows that do this. Chris Jericho, Steve Austin, Jim Ross, big shows and small shows. shows. Those Podcast One shows, that money goes to Podcast One. It doesn't go directly to the host of the show. So when you think about which referral link to use, just remember, fuck those guys. Support us right here on the Super Podcast. Bix, really quick.
I was right. This is a telethon. Is that how you say that, Tiny? I thought it was 10-year-old. When I've seen that, I don't even know what the fuck it is, but I was seeing it as 10-year-old.
It is Tiny URL.
Well, I was going to say I wouldn't have seen that because I didn't know there was a word named URL, URL, but I don't know what a URL would be.
A URL is a web address.
Ah, well, there you go.
Bix, real quick, what are the links for our international listeners?
Okay, for people in the UK and Ireland, it is tinyurl.com/605AmazonUK. And for Canada, it is tinyurl.com/605AmazonCA.
That's the funniest word I've ever heard to me now. Tiny Earl.
Well, Tiny Earl.
That should have been fucking Earl Hebner's gimmick. Instead of Baby Earl, he should have been Tiny Earl.
Well, before we move forward with the show, it is now time for our weekly tribute to our great friend Dennis Caraluzzo, the late great independent promoter and one of the greatest characters in the history of civilization. And we have a very special guest this week for the Dennis of the Week. So at this time, let's please roll tape, Bix. And here is our conversation with star maker Kenny Bolin. So here for a big Dennis of the Week, we have a very, very special guest, star maker Kenny Bolin. Kenny, thanks for coming on the show today.
Well, just to tell you what a big favor this is I'm doing for you, I turned down three other podcasts that I was supposed to do today that I actually forgot that I was supposed to do. I'm sick as a dog. I think you've heard that. Your producers contacted me yesterday. I told them I was sick as a dog. Somehow let them talk me into doing this anyway, but let's get it over with and go ahead and no, I'm messing with you a little bit, man. You and I got off to a bad start. And here's where you and I were screwing up at. We were both trying to be the number two man for Jimmy Cornette. And I don't know if I've ever relished in my head that I was number two, because I know that now six of the top seven rated shows he's ever done, I have been the guest on the show. And yes, Jim Ross, yes, Lance Storm, yes, Rip Rogers, and yes, a few other of you world-renowned wrestlers, I beat you all. Poor little guy here that's never been on worldwide television in his life other than to be seen with John Cena in a highlight reel. And not Jericho's highlight reel. I don't think I've ever been on that, but that would be an honor. But you and I were we were battling to be number two, and what we didn't realize is that we're 1A and 1B. Cornette has fallen to two or three. He is now the least popular guy on the show. People want to hear me. They want to hear you. And I'm only on about once every 6 weeks, if that. And at least you're on every week. But people they don't want to hear Cornette no more. They've heard his shit every week, same old crap every week, same shit, same political rant, same local my yard's falling apart rant, same the mayor hates me, Rand. It's always something. That why would people across the world want to hear that? And they're tuning in to hear what you and I have to say. So we have to realize we're not one, or we're not two, we're not three. We're 1A, 1B, and you're on more than I am, so hell, I'll even give you 1A. I'm in a generous mood today.
Well, thank you very much, Kenny, and certainly we've heard from a lot of listeners who have said they want to hear more of me talking with you, so that's why it's such a treat to have you here on the Super
Podcast. There has been a lot of requests for me to do your show, not only from your fans, but my fans alone have asked me to do your show. So, no, we're doing it today. I'm not feeling real well, but we're going to do the best we can, and I'm here, and you just ask of me, and I shall provide.
Well, I think where we have to start, Kenny, is with the Dennis of the Week. The Dennis of the Week is our weekly tribute to a mutual friend of ours, Dennis Caraluzzo. And previous people who have been on the show doing the Dennis of the Week, Tom Robinson, John McAdam, Jim Cornette, have all mentioned Dennis's relationship with you. And I got to admit, I didn't know too much about it because, as I told you on Jimmy's show, I first met you at the Eddie Gilbert Memorial Brawl in 1998 in Philadelphia. Right. And I just thought you were Jim's friend and you were there and you were going to manage for the weekend. I didn't realize that you and Dennis had already had this relationship. So why don't we start with, tell me how you first met Dennis.
Well, I guess where we actually first met is he had heard countless stories about me from Cornette. And so somehow, I think he got my number. I'm trying to go by memory here. But he had heard a thousand, you know, of course, the Kroger meat scam story and all that. And that just fascinated Dennis. He just was amazed by a guy could make a couple of grand in a week and not spend any of his own money and really technically not be breaking the law. So that just blew him away. So he ended up calling me and we talked and he told me he was dear friends with Jimmy and I liked him immediately. He just had that type of personality that, yeah, he's a cool guy. I can get along with him. And he informed me that he was coming to Nashville for to do something wrestling related there. And then, and guys, forget the cough button because if I hit it every time, you're never going to hear me. And he informed me then that he was going to be going on to this big convention in Memphis that Jerry Lawler was going to be a part of and asked me if I'd like to go. He says, as a matter of fact, I need you to go because I'm going to get a rental car. And it would be a huge favor to me if you would return that rental car back to Nashville. I'm going to land in Nashville. We'll hang out there for a couple of days. We'll have some fun. Go to Memphis. You bring the rental car back for me. I'll reward you greatly for your trouble. And I'm like, all right. You know, and you know, Core loses sound, whether he was or not. To listen to him, you think he was bankrolling $1 million somewhere. He, yeah. big spender. Money's no object. Everything's on me. And it was, I mean, well, sort of. So, when he gets there, I think the first night there, he actually rents a limo. And I had a former roommate of mine that had moved to Nashville just out of accident. He didn't know I was in Nashville and I sure as hell didn't know he was coming. But this guy looked dead like, Huey Lewis. He was, you put glasses on him and you couldn't tell the two apart. So, and this blew Dennis away also. He meets the guy and he said, my God, son bitch does look like Huey Lewis. He said, man, he said, I was thinking of treating you and your wife and little Chris to a dinner. Where's your favorite place to eat? I said, we love TGI Fridays. Well, I'm going to rent a limo and we're going to get Huey Lewis here and we're going to get the VIP treatment and we're going to go to TGI Fridays tonight. So I want you to know he does rent the limo and there we go. We pull up and we're all wearing suits and ties. Which is hard to get me in a suit and tie if you guys have known me very long. And so we pull up, and so we're putting Huey Lewis over. And he's eating his shit up because he's just a struggling cookware salesman, barely paying his rent, and tonight he is a fucking celebrity. And so we pull up, and me and Corluza are frontline security. You know, we're getting everybody to step back. We're making sure that the table's reserved. And we called ahead and set up a table reserved for Mr. Lewis. We never said his name was Huey. So when we get there, I said, is Mr. Lewis's table available, please? Yes, it is. And so the limo gets out. And then my wife and kid and a couple of others that are with us, I think Tony Cron and Jane Cron that we worked for with the cookware company at that time. And here me and Dennis are basically, we're frontline mafia security. This is exactly what we look like. And Huey's right in the middle of us. So we, George Moore was his name. So we're walking in and we're pushing people back. Anybody's getting close, we're pushing them back. Please, please, no pictures, no, please. And most of the people in there had no fucking clue that anybody named Mr. Lewis was coming to eat there. But now the buzz is going around the whole fucking place. They all went to come and see Mr. Lewis. We get to our table. We're off in a secluded area. We get the piss boys to stand guard. They're making sure that no one comes down to bother us at our table. They hadn't officially become fully honorary piss boys yet, and you'll know that story here in a little bit. But they're on to getting ready to become the piss boys. And so they're standing guard, making sure nobody fucks with us. And now it's time for us to leave. And now we have to make room. And we like to never got out of that fucking place because everybody thought Huey Lewis was having dinner with. And he can take his glasses off. And from a distance, unless you was right up on him, you would have swore this motherfucker was Huey Lewis. So, and he was a big deal back then. That was back, hell, we're talking 80, 87, 88, probably about 88, I guess.
The Memphis convention was 88, so I think.
Okay,
so.
88. You probably know better than I do. And so 88, and Huey Lewis was still a reasonably big deal back then. And we liked and never did get to our damn car, the limo. We almost ribbed ourselves people, and Fridays was pissed when they found out the next day it wasn't Huey Lewis. But they never knew till then. And then one of the managers there knew me real well, and he called me. He said, why in the hell didn't you tell us that that wasn't Huey Lewis? We just fucking having some fun. And oh, he was fucking mad because they said everybody in there bought it hook, line, and sinker. And that was basically Corleone's idea, and I sure shit wasn't going to rent a limo. And apparently he had some type of budget to be able to get it, so he got it, and I didn't ask how. And so that was one of the ones that Piss Boy left out. He might have forgot. He
Well, let's just clarify for the listeners. When you say Piss Boy, you're speaking of Tom Robinson, and when you say Piss Boys...
I never, ever knew his name as Tom Robinson until, hell, a few years ago. I've only known him as Piss Boy. And he used to... He friended me on Facebook and chatted with me forever. And here's the thing. When Piss Boy became Piss Boy... And this is no bullshit. He might have been 6 feet tall. And if he weighed 150 pounds, he couldn't have weighed an ounce. There's no way he weighed over 150. And his buddy, who's, I'm sorry, I can't, who was Piss Boy?
Joe Lilly.
You know, I haven't heard anything out of him since that day, I guess.
Okay.
In Memphis, Tennessee. Has anybody heard anything from him?
He's still out there. Tom has mentioned him to us, so I'm assuming he's out there. Yeah.
Yeah. So Tom has been around. We've stayed reasonably close for quite some time once I realized that Tom was Piss Boy. But he was friends of mine on Facebook forever. And he says, Kenny, it's Pissy. And I'm looking at this big jacked up son of a bitch, motorcycle looking thug, and going, what? Who? What? No way. And he just transformed into this creature. There was no way in hell was the Piss Boy. So it just ruined it for me, because now this guy looked like he could whip my ass, and we just totally flat out abused the Piss Boy in a good way. They benefited heavily. They got a lot of free merchandise out of the deal, and they got to hang with me and Dennis and to meet Jerry Lawler and various others. So that leads to us eventually now going to Memphis. And there was a girl... You might, goddamn, you were so young then. I don't know how you're going to know these names, but there was a girl there I had a fit over, and she was 100% personified Philadelphia. And she went to that convention. I cannot think of her name. I can picture her. I can picture the outfit she wore, brunette girl. And like I said, she was, four words could come out of her mouth, and you'd know exactly what part of Philadelphia she was from. And apparently the name doesn't mean anything to you either.
Yeah, I don't know who that is.
Yeah, I don't. But I had a fit for her, and Corleone was doing everything he could to fix me up with her. So eventually we finally hooked up. Didn't go quite as good as I wanted. We were probably rounding third coming for home, and that's when she tells me that her boyfriend's there at the convention with her, and she feels terrible. I said, oh, shit. So I didn't want to get any heat going with Corleone and the people that were there with him. And yeah, shit, third base was good enough for the time. Corleone didn't bother to tell me the girl's boyfriend was goddamn there. So that led to Dennis once, allegedly. Let's throw allegedly, because I don't know. This story might even be in my book. I can't remember. But allegedly, some credit cards were lost. And somebody found them. And then somebody went shopping.
Now, we've heard this story a few times on this show.
Yeah.
A few different times.
Well, the Piss, really? Well, lots of people telling that story, huh? Well, this
Jim Cornette and Tom Robinson have both told the story on the show.
Well, Jimmy has no clue other than what he's been told. Robinson knows most of it because he went on a lot of the shopping spree with me. So if mine alters any from what he said, you let me know. But the first thing that we got is that this person that lost his credit cards, he said, well, you need to upgrade your video camera. You need a better video camera. You're going to be shooting a lot of this convention. You can probably sell the tapes, which I did. And we'd go out and get you a new camera. He said, but here's the deal. You got 24 hours. After that, these sumbitches are being reported stolen. You've got about a $10,000 limit here. I've never used either one of these. The person that lost the cards told me that, or told the guy this. Woo! And you don't want to incriminate anybody. You want to change the names to protect the guilty. You understand here.
I gotcha.
So the first place we go, or they went with, sir, boy, I got to learn how to lie, don't I? I'm just not a good liar. So these people go to Circuit City. And this is the amazing thing. The person that lost the card had a New Jersey license. And this freaking amazed me to this day. Those licenses in New Jersey did not have a picture. I don't quite understand the logic of having a license without a picture. And the person that lost the card was also left-handed. So said person who found the cards could do the signature almost identical to the character that lost the cards. And there was no picture ID, so they couldn't look at it and say, well, this isn't you or him or whatever. So the first thing we get is a $2,200. I mean, I'd be terrible on a stand. They got a $2,200 video camera, and they are thinking, holy shit, we're off and running here. So the next thing you know, a trip was made to one of the biggest malls in Memphis. I can't remember the name of it. My son benefited some of these gifts, a Philadelphia Eagles t-shirt. Don't know why the hell one was in Memphis, but no, I take that back. Godfather Dennis brought that with him as a gift for Chris. So that did not come from the mall. What did come from the mall was a rubber action figure of Underdog, which my son still has to this day, that he got in 88. We both love Underdog. We love that figure. It's been a mainstay. We've been through so much shit, so many homes, couple of fires, but yet Underdog keeps surviving. The Piss Boys got a couple of sets of matching outfits. Said person and said founder of the cards also got a couple of matching outfits. And that was the day that the Piss Boys got their name, is when they donned their red and white striped shirts. And there's a thousand pictures of them in these shirts. I have seen them. I don't know if they still exist for public knowledge or not, but I've seen them. And that was the birth of the Piss Boys. And the spree basically expired the entire $10,000 limit on those cards. The person that lost the card, from what I was told, the only thing that person, he or she, wanted out of that entire shopping spree was a new Nikon camera. So the person that found the card felt it only decent to make sure that he got said person that prize that he wanted. So I saw and so I heard. So that was really all he got, other than the outfits and a few various things that the person that found the card felt obligated to pick up for the person. And where am I going with it? Oh, I get a call. No, I'm not done. I get a call a few weeks after the convention. And apparently the people from the card company decided to, now this is what he told me, that the person of the representative of the card company, along with law enforcement, came to his home looking for merchandise that was purchased with that card. And in his closet were some of those clothes, the Nikon camera, and a couple of various other things. And he was freaking terrified. He was on the phone with me while they were there and assuring me that the person that found the card, because I was a friend of the person that found the card, and he was assuring me that that person would not be ratted out. He was not a snitch, but shit could be going south. And he was very concerned about what might happen to him. And apparently nothing ever happened out of it, because he never, you know, he apparently never went away, and it never really was talked about much anymore, because his said person's wife had no idea any of this shit happened and did not even really know. I think she was told that I bought the camera for him, or the said person bought the camera for him. Yeah, I can never sit on a witness stand. They'd crack me in about 25 seconds.
Well, I think it was Oh, I'm sorry, Kenny. Go ahead.
No, that's about it. That was we basically all thought we thought people were going to go down for this, but it never did happen.
Well, I think there's a few important things to note. One is that at least up here in the Northeast, the statute of limitations for fraud is 6 years. So I think
in Tennessee, they say that any felony, there is no statute of limitations. Now, that is what I've been told. That's what Dean Hill told me, who is a former cop. He said that in Kentucky and Tennessee, that because I've asked him specifically, and he says that any felony, because I thought it was only murder that there was no statute of limitations on. And to my knowledge, me or Dennis, neither one have ever killed anybody. I don't recall it if we did. And, let's face it. You know Dennis told you he killed somebody, didn't he?
I can't comment on that.
Can't comment on it. All right. Well, it's not like they're going to get him now.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Kenny. You said at the beginning of our conversation that Dennis was impressed when he heard the story of the Kroger meat scam. Yeah. For our listeners, can you explain what that was?
Briefly, because this story has been told so goddamn many times. And if they know anything about me at all, they have heard this story, and either from me, Cornette, Piss Boy, whomever. Basically, how it started out, once again, allegedly, in Nashville, Tennessee, accidentally discovered this. Me and my wife, Gabrielle at the time, went shopping at a local Kroger there, and we bought, I guess it was 6 to 8 pounds of ground beef, something like that, at like $1.99 a pound, whatever. I told you this thing was going to catch up with me eventually. And we go shopping. We buy the 8 pounds of hamburger. Comes with about $16. We're planning a little cookout there in the duplex that we live in. And there were some neighbors that rent a duplex. So we're going to be cooking burgers for about 6-8 people. And I'm damn if those damn burgers, they had gristle in them and just wasn't the quality ground beef that we normally get from Kroger's. So we cooked up, I'd say, better than half of it. And then we took the other half back and expected to get back our $16. And then when Gabrielle comes out of the store, because I sat in the car with Chris, and when she comes back out, she hands me like $35, $36. I said, Gab, is some of this your money? I said, the refund's only supposed to be about $16, $17. No, that's what they gave me. I said, you sure? I looked at the receipt and it said double your money back, meat guarantee. I said, well, hell, I said, they just gave us double our money back. I said, well, I've seen those commercials. I said, it says if you try meat at Kroger and you're not satisfied, we'll double your money back. I said, I totally forgot all about that. I said, yeah, hell, that's all right. So then I start thinking, oh, hell, if they'll do that on damn 8 pounds of hamburger, imagine what they do for the expensive meat. So we went again, and I think we bought the expensive steaks and probably got about $40 worth of steaks. Well, of course, we didn't like them. We found glitches and problems with all of them. I think we even saw something green in one of them. So we go back, and now we get back with Tennessee sales tax. You know, it's 8.75% down there. We get back almost $90. So not only do we eat all the steak we want, we spend 40, get back nearly 90 after taxes. And I said, shit, this is all right. So then to make a long story a little shorter, I discovered we go in there and they had these big giant pork loins. These son of a bitches were, God, 3-4 feet long. And it was some type of a pork loin, because some pork loins are reasonably inexpensive. These son of a bitches cost $100-something each, down to as low as maybe $90-something each. But 90 to about 111 was the price range on these things. And I'm looking at Gabrielle. I said, I got a plan here. She says, Kenny, if they don't honor that, we're going to lose $100. I don't want to spend $100 on a piece of meat we're going to be stuck with. We'll never be able to eat all that. And I said, well, that's where you're wrong. I said, we're not going to double our money back on this one. We're going to get 4 times our money back. Well, how are you going to do that? I said, just let's get the meat. I'll take the hit. It ain't going to come out of your money. It'll come out of mine. I said, well, let me show you what we're going to do. So we go home. We cut from the middle of the meat and have a big cookout for us and the neighbors and everything. And then we eat we eat like fucking kings. And that leaves a fair portion of each end of the meat still left. So what we did is took one portion of the meat with the price tag on it back to the store that it was bought from and got double our money back plus Tennessee sales tax there. So that was lower right in the neighborhood of about $230. Then we take the receipt and the other piece back to any other Kroger. Didn't matter. As long as you had the receipt, you could go to any Kroger basically in that general area. And they had, hell, probably 15 Krogers in the general Nashville area. If they had one, they probably had more than that. And then we got back $230-something there. So we spent about $111 and made about $460. Now we're talking a fucking profit on your return. So if that'll happen here, so then I start scoping out all the Krogers in the area. Nashville, Knoxville, Chattanooga, Atlanta. So we went as far south as Atlanta. Wouldn't go into Cincinnati because that's where corporate offices were. So I didn't want to fuck with Cincinnati. And allegedly, you know, if I did do this, this is how I would have done it. My good buddy OJ told me to say that. And we did this for the neighborhood of 5 years. There were some weeks that, I think a little over two, almost some weeks, $3,000 was made if it was needed. And if the money was needed, it was easily made until Mal Bolin fucked it up. And I'll tell that story on another show. It's been told, but the next time you and I are together, I will tell how Mal Bolin fucked all that up.
Well, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, she single-handedly put an end to the quadruple your money back meat scam, as they call it.
Well, another couple times here on the show, we heard different stories about you with Dennis. So before we go forward asking you about other stuff, let me ask you, Kenny, what Tom Robinson talked about.
To my knowledge, Dennis never actually, because I don't think they had Kroger's in the Philadelphia, New Jersey market.
I don't think so.
And I don't think he ever actually tried it, even though he was just fucking blown away by the concept of it. Make $2,000 or $3,000 a week buying meat and eat like a fucking king.
Well, I wasn't. It really king. Is I something.
I swear to God, I never saw anything illegal about it. And finally, Jimmy even caved in. He said, well, Kenny, it wasn't really a meat scam. It was a meat opportunity. And I said, well, that's kind of how I like to look at it.
That's a good way to put it. Speaking of food and Dennis, Tom Robinson mentioned here on the show a famous dine-in dash.
Where
Dennis hid behind a pillar while you walked right out and left your wife and baby in the restaurant. What are your memories of that incident?
Tom left out a few things about that because he claims that we crashed this particular event. And it.
Let me stop you there. There are two different stories.
I've heard both of them.
Crashed a wedding. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, he has apparently a little bit more memory of that wedding that was crashed than I do. What I do remember real well is the hiding behind the pillars and the people in the hats and then the various things. Here's what happened. He says that he is treating all of us to this grand breakfast buffet at the Opryland Hotel. We're invited guests. And it's a $250 a plate fundraiser. We don't have to pay a thing. He's got it all taken care of. And you and little Christopher and Gabrielle, the Piss Boys are going to be there. Everybody come on down. It's going to be a great time. So we show up there, and I swear my hand to God, I had no clue what was about to go down. And so we go in there, and poor little Gabrielle certainly doesn't have any clue. So we go in, we sit down, and all of this is major fucking league, man. We're sitting, we're being served. You don't even have to get up to get anything. They got people in goddamn coats and ties and tuxes bringing us any goddamn thing we want. You name it, and it's coming to the table. And then eventually the time of the evening gets here that each person at that table is supposed to be cutting a check for $250 a person, probably exempting Christopher because he's a one-year-old baby. And then that's when Corlusa says, hey, Kenny, I ain't got any cash. We're going to have to get the fuck out of here. I said, holy shit. I got a plan. Just follow me. So one by one, he starts orchestrating everybody to get up and either go to the bathroom, gotta go here. Everybody's got a different reason they gotta go somewhere. And then it gets down to the point to where the Piss Boys are left, me, Gabrielle, and Chris. And I'm looking at the Piss Boys. The Piss Boys are going, this is fucked up. And I said, well, I'll be goddamn if they're getting any money out of me. I said, Gabrielle, I said, you and Chris, you all go to go. Well, Kenny, what's the matter? There's been a mix up. I said, just please get up and go to the car. So she gets up and goes to the car. Well, now some people are starting to get a little suspicious because now it's just me and the Piss Boys. I said, guys, I said, we still got to cut you a check for this shit. Fortunately, I was wearing shorts and a t-shirt to this fucking bang up thing and looking like a fool to begin with because I had no idea what this thing was. And I said, guys, I don't have my checkbook on me. Let me go to the car and get a check and get y'all settled up on this. Well, Coraluza is already trying to get to the damn car, and they're looking for him already because he was kind of acting like the big wig of the whole thing anyway. So he was kind of seen as the grand poobah who was going to be, I think, under the assumption he was cutting a check for everybody. So they were looking for him, and my hand to God, this is exactly how it happened. Coraluza is hiding behind the pillar. Me and the Piss Boys are trying to guide him as where to go on that pillar as security. And there was a guy in a chef's hat out there. I didn't see a meat cleaver, so I don't know how much damage he was going to cause. But there were two security guards and a guy in a chef's hat who apparently was preparing all these fine meals that we had. It was just like out of the damn Keystone Cops where he's sliding around that pillar. They're going around, and none of them ever goddamn see each other. It looks like it's out of an Abbott and Costello movie or something. And once he got the clear, we yelled, go, go, go. Coraluza, if you've ever seen him run, it's not a pretty sight. He's going as fast as he can to get to the car. The Piss Boys had got out there and got the car. We had two of them. So they pulled the cars up because we had a shitload of people with us. I just can't remember everybody that was with us. And security basically chasing us out the door. I'm driving one car, and I think it was one of the Piss Boys. If not, it was Dennis. I didn't really look because we were just trying to get the fuck out of there. Because if they had caught us, God knows what would have happened. But no, Gabrielle made it to the car. I think they told the story as I left Chris and Gabrielle behind, and that was not exactly true. We did get them filtered out, and they was in the car with me when I left. It makes a better story if we tell them that I left them behind, but that's not exactly how it happened. Now, to the wedding crashing thing, I hate to do this, Tom, but I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. I do not remember us crashing a wedding. It's a great story. And the thing is, that might have happened. I just don't think I was there. I don't remember, but it is a hell of a story. I mean, hell, I thought about just calling up and adding to it. And just making it even more, but I think he's got me confused for somebody else.
Well, whether you were there or not, it definitely did happen because we actually asked Tom about it because we had heard about it from other people who knew the story. They said, you have to ask Tom about when it happened.
How many people say I was there? Because my memory, my long-term memory is great. I can't tell you what the fuck I did yesterday, but my long-term memory is normally pretty damn good. How many people say I was there?
The only person who may have said it was you, it would either be John McAdam or Jamie Ward. And I'm not certain if they said you were there.
Now, if enough people come forward and say I was there, then I guess I'll have to suck up and say I was. But I just don't remember that. It's a hell of a story. I don't know how I'd forget it. Wish I was there. And I'd like to have been on the microphone and congratulating everybody, too. But so if we can get three people to claim I was there, I guess I'll have to accept it. But I just don't know where was that also in the Opryland Hotel as well? Hell, we might have done the same day.
Well, I'm not sure. I believe that may have been in Memphis.
I wonder if that did happen at the convention in Memphis because there was so much shit going on that weekend. I mean, I barely even remember us sitting down and hanging. Lawler's shit when he saw me walk through the door because I didn't make a lot of trips to Memphis back then. They were rare. And if they were, he normally knew about them and knew me and Cornette and Thelma were coming. And when me and Coraluza walked through the door together, because I think Dennis had already done a little TV with Lawler by then, or had he not?
I'm not sure if he had done TV yet, but they definitely knew each other already.
Yeah, I knew that he, I knew he eventually, he ended up being an attorney, I think, and did some managing on Memphis TV, which I'm a little jealous of, because I never got to do any of that for actual Memphis TV. That would have been a blast. And McCornett saw that shit never happened. Jerry Jarrett still cusses him to this day for that. And that is a absolute shoot. I made a posting on my Facebook wall about some real nice things Jerry Jarrett said to me a couple of years ago when he was in Louisville. He wrote me and told me he was going to be here, said he'd like to meet me. And I arranged to have him picked up at the show he was doing and took him out to dinner, got everything covered. And boy, he wrote a very flattering letter and basically just bitch slapped Jimmy Cornette all through it. About what a liar he was, what a good, decent human being I was, and what a great asset to the business I'd have been, and how many millions of dollars that Cornette cost him with the feud he could have had between me and Cornette. He says, if he thinks him and Hart drew me money, imagine what you two could have done. I said, I have imagined. I have. And plus, we'd have had the energy and the size and the youth to have actually been entertaining back then, rather than two old fat fucks in OVW. But we had some entertaining times in OVW as well.
You did, and I'm certain that would have been a really fun feud. Let me ask you this, Kenny. After the 88 convention in Memphis, when do you next see or hear from Dennis?
Oh, God. I guess, you know what? Probably the Gilbert Memorial. We talked all the time. I mean, we was always calling each other, but I think actually seeing each other was there. And a lot of people don't know this. A lot of people think I was just a little side favor for Jimmy. Corluza demanded I be on that show. He had come up here and had done some shit with IWA. He came up here and did some shit with IWA and asked me if I'd be a part of it. And I knew nothing about them. Not knowing what I was getting myself into, I was doing it as a favor for Dennis. And he kept saying, well, I can't be here every week. Let me introduce you to these people. Let me get you. I said, Dennis, I'm in shorts and a sleeveless shirt. How much heat do you think I can get? He says, you're going to fucking get plenty. Don't worry about it. So I'm out there, you know, because Dennis is dressed to the nines, got his suit, and he's playing the mafia gig and everything. And here I come out in a pair of brown khaki shorts and a black sleeveless T-shirt. And he's trying to get the heat started. And I'll be damned if it didn't work. And when Dennis left, I showed up in a olive-colored suit, black turtleneck, black pants. And I'll be goddamn if one of the fans didn't throw nacho cheese all over me my first night in the fucking new suit that I worked at Humana in. And I said, damn mad. And I was wanting to pull that son of a bitch down and just beat the shit out of him, but knowing that was probably going to be the end of my Louisville managerial career if I did. So I let it slide and just gave him the dirty look and learned my lesson. And that's when I managed all IWA shows in a KWO T-shirt, a black members-only jacket, and a black pair of jogging pants. I said, if they're going to ruin something, it ain't going to be a goddamn $300 sport coat. And I never dressed up again for a wrestling show until I ended up with OVW and Danny Davis. But no, it was a favor for Corluza to do IWA. And that way, when he wasn't there, that's when I kind of took over. And the next thing I know, I'm managing 9 out of 11 matches a night, cutting promos in every goddamn one of them. And it's hard to go out and make 9 different promos and keep any heat. That's what I used to dislike about Jimmy Hart. Jimmy Hart was on the whole goddamn show. He'd be out there for how many times can you give a shit about what Jimmy Hart's got to say? And because that was the great thing about Ric Flair. If you saw Ric Flair once and got one promo, but if he was out there 5 times, how much would they fucking mean? Same with Jimmy. Same. Well, maybe I'd let it slide on Bobby Heenan because Bobby's going to be entertaining every damn time. But it's amazing I had any damn heat at all over there as much as they ran me out. But somehow it worked. Danny Davis saved me just in time. He discovered me over there for their Gilbert Memorial. And I was thankful to be a part of that because not only did I get to work with Tommy Gilbert, Tommy Rich, and Terry Bam Bam Gordy, and along with, oh, hell, Tracy Smothers and Timothy Wells and Stephen Dunn and Salvatore Sincere, who you probably know pretty well. Tom Brandy.
Sure, he worked for Dennis a bunch.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he was at a lot of those IWA shows, too. And I got to work with Dutch Mantel there quite a bit. And Dutch kept my sanity. He gave me one of the best bits of advice I ever got in the wrestling business. He says, Kenny, you're pretty damn good at this. He said, but here's the thing. There's a lot of great managers that are in the WWE now that can't get 30 seconds of airtime. He says, so don't cast your dreams there. Not saying you can or cannot make it, but treat this as your golf. There's a lot of people that spend a shitload of money to play golf and they have a fucking ball at it and it cost them a fortune. You're actually going to make some money at this. But this is your golf. You're going to make some money. I don't know how much, but you ain't going to go broke. And you're going to have a ball and you're going to be pretty damn good. And he told me that, probably 96, I guess, 97. And that was probably the best advice I ever got, because that's kind of how I treated it. And then by the time we got the deal at OVW, and then I got to write my own check by selling advertising on the shows, plus getting paid for performing on those WWE shows and what pennies I picked up on an OVW show. And then I learned how to sell merchandise. And Danny doesn't know this to this day. I guess he's going to find out now. There were many OVW shows that I tripled what OVW profited on their shows. Me alone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he knows now. And I had to guard that with a passion, because it killed the boys that I would sit there and just sell all that shit. And it pissed me off, though, that they'd have heels coming up to sell pictures. You're a heel on the show and you're out there trying to sell pictures and 8x10s and all, and then you got to come out and try and get them to hate you. I was forbidden to do that as a heel. When I was a heel manager, if we'd have even thought of selling merchandise, we'd have been fired on the spot. And then somehow, once we got hooked up with the WWE, Danny started letting it happen. And then we had no real heels. No one had any fucking heat. I take that back. It was once the WWE contract ended, right around 2008, 2009. And that's when the shit hit the fan and the inmates were running the asylum. But now Dennis really let me know that I could do it on a national basis, because I was his invited guest to be on that show. Cornette produced it, of course, because Cornette ain't going to be involved in anything that he ain't going to overproduce 15 times over. And he thinks he's going to do this breakfast with buffet bowling. He thinks he's going to overproduce that, but I got news for him. He'll find out when he gets there. But that gave me the confidence that I could do that at a national level. I got a lot of compliments from the major stars that were on that show. Psycho Sid, who I was amazed showed up. I was booked on three other shows with Psycho Sid. I was on three other shows with Psycho Sid, and he was 0-for-3. So I was blown away that he actually showed up for that one. And King Kong Bundy, I think, was there that day. Was Dan Severn on that one as well?
Dan Severn against Franz Schumann.
Yeah. And of course, Sonny no-showed us on that one. What else is new? And I got to do a great little segment with Marlena that I had a ball with, where I basically tried to replace Goldust as her side piece, and didn't pan out too well. But that was still probably one of the most fun shows I ever did. Number one, they let me steal the show. They stuck me out there five times, which that show I didn't mind doing it, because we were shoving that Fox 41 and Big 58 shit down the fans' throat. And the two local television stations I worked for in Louisville at that time probably had more heat than I did. They were so sick of hearing that I was a big TV star on a real network. And you probably remember the chants to this day. Fox 41 sucks. You know, half the arena would go Fox 41. The other half would go suck. Big 58 sucks. So Jimmy says, God damn, you've gotten the TV stations fucking heat. They hate the goddamn stations. Shove them stations down their fucking throat, man. You're going to be out there a few more times, and every time, reintroduce yourself. Tell them you're a big TV star. You're on the Fox 41. You're on the Big 58. You're a two-time television star. By the way, I am on at 1:30 a.m. on the Fox 41. You can see me at 3 a.m. on the Big 58. Like, who gives a fuck? And then I'm burying the USA Network and TNN, which is what ECW was on. And, of course, USA with WWE. I was treating them like they were just fucking secondary. And just all this shit was pretty much on the fly. Jimmy just said, go out there, try and get some heat. And then once he realized the fans hated that fucking, the two TV stations I worked at, he said, just shove that down their throat. And it was the ball. I had a blast. That's one of the most fun shows I ever did. And that included, and you got to remember, I worked in front of nearly 20,000 people at Freedom Hall, managing Rico and Cena against Brock and Shelton. I don't know how many people that place in Philadelphia had. I would guess, 1,000, maybe 2?
I would say probably between 1,000 and 1,200, somewhere in there.
Yeah. And I had as much fun there, if not more, than I did doing the WWE show. Mainly when you get to do 5 promos and you realize everybody in the building just fucking hates your guts. Because I didn't get to do a promo on the WWE show, but everybody fucking knew us. And, you know, not all 20,000, of course, but they knew us when we left because Brock put on a hell of a show. Cena and Rico looked great, and I got to do some shit. So those were probably my 2 favorite shows I ever did. And it's amazing that a 1,200-person show can compete with a 20,000-person show. But Dennis honored the payday he told me he would give me, and he actually paid me more for working that show and after especially factoring in my travel expenses than the WWE paid me for being the last match before Raw started. And here's what a lot of people don't realize is that me, Rico, and Cena almost got to open up Raw that night and challenge Brock and Shelton to come back out for a rematch for the titles because they had just beaten us for the titles. Crowd was going apeshit. Brock did the fucking crazy-ass fucking move he does.
The shooting star press?
Yeah, it was the only time that a dark match got 3 replays on the Titantron. From what I've been told, they said a dark match had never got that before. Crowd was going apeshit. And guess what? The first match was not ready to go. My hand to God, I am not lying to you. We're in the gorilla position. We're getting complimented up one side and down the other. Cornette and Ross are talking. And they said, guys, you want to go back out and open Raw? And I want you to go out there and I want you to challenge them some bitches and come back. And they're going to put those titles back up. Call it in the ring. I said, you're shitting me. We're going to fucking open Raw. I look at Cena and Rico. Let's do it. Let's do it. Fuck yeah. And we're there. We're seconds away from opening fucking Raw. And then I'll be goddamn if that match wasn't ready to go. We got pulled. And then whatever the opening match was ready. And we did not get to open Raw. But would that have been fucking huge or what? And there's not a lot of people know that story. Not a lot of people. I don't even know if Cornette's ever told it. But, it was him and Ross and one other person there in the gorilla position letting us know, hey, we got to have something to open up with. We're going live. And our match is not ready. I don't know why. I don't even remember who. I just remember being real pissed. They're ready. And we were probably 20 seconds away from going out. That is how close the call it was. Can you imagine what a fucking... People would have been saying, oh, my God, there's Bolin, Rico, Cena, Lesnar. This ain't OVW. It was, oh, my God. Well, you ain't going to believe who's trying to call me now. Jimmy Cornette. Should I answer this and put him on the air?
No. I don't know about that.
You know what? Just don't say anything and I'm going to answer.
Okay.
Hello.
Sick boy.
Yeah, I'm a little bit sick. What are you doing?
Well, what did your nurse give you?
Doctors called. They recommended me to go to an immediate care center because they think it's going to be too much trouble on me to get to the to their facility because they're on the 9th floor parking and all that. So I got to go to an immediate care center here a little bit later tonight.
Why are you waiting till later tonight?
Because that's what I fucking want to do.
You realize that for one of these urgent care centers, if you go in the middle of the day when doctor's offices have their appointments hours and et cetera, that it's much easier to get in than at night where everything else is closed and that's people's only option.
Well, I just got the word that I had this option like 30 minutes ago, and I have promised some people that I would try and knock out a podcast or two today. And
oh, for God's sake. You're going to get pneumonia and you're doing
No, you know why I'm not going to get pneumonia? Because I've never had pneumonia a day in my life. I am a bowling. I am a cockroach. And if I was going to get pneumonia, I'd know it. I'm going to be fine. I'm going to take the fucking antibiotic and I'm going to be fine. Why? Did you find my will or something?
No, I'm trying to keep you around because of fucking comedic value on the show. I can't lose the ratings bump.
If I had any comedic value, you would have me on three times a week.
Well, I don't do three shows a week.
Oh, well, that sounds like a good excuse. Well,
so you've done nothing about your health?
Well, I had a bowl of soup. I did have some soup, and I am going to go to the Immediate Care Center at Walgreens probably within the next hour. I got a call.
Walgreens has one?
Pardon? Well, they say they do. That's what they told me. But see, okay. I have no IDs. I got to go to where they got my shit on file. I don't have any IDs. Remember, I lost my wallet.
Oh, for God's
lost
sake.
My dinner card. I can't prove who I am. I'm nobody.
But you're okay. So you're going to this place in the next little while.
Yes. Probably
how
within.
Are they open?
Well, they're open 24 hours. Well, the Immediate Care Center, I think, is open till 10.
I was going to say they're not open 24 hours if it's Walgreens.
Yeah. Well, the Walgreens is open 24 hours, but the Immediate Care Center, I think, is open till 10. Yeah. But yeah, I'm about to do that.
I went to Walgreens one time for Stacy some cold medicine. It was that shit they put back behind the counter because people make meth out of it. I couldn't even get that.
Really?
At 11 o'clock at fucking night.
Fuck. Well, maybe if you two weren't known fucking drug dealers and pushers in the neighborhood, maybe they'd let you have some.
No, they make you take a little card off the fucking shelf and take it up to the pharmacist and sign for it that you only got one box or whatever.
Well, see, I've only had two colds in 7 years, and I've never had to do that. I don't think those laws were implemented back when I was sick last time.
It's like the last couple of years they've started doing. I said, look at me. I said, how much meth am I going to make, and it's worth my while, out of this one box of goddamn cough medicine, 9 tablets?
How much could you make? I don't know. How much could you make?
None.
Oh, none? Oh, well.
Quantities of that shit.
I thought maybe you knew. I don't know. You're world renowned when it comes to those things. I didn't know.
There's been documentaries and news reports on this very topic that I'm telling you right now that they've implemented these laws, and you don't know anything about it.
And if you care about me so much, why is it taking you to 553 to get around to talking to me today?
Because the guy was here mowing my lawn.
Oh, well, that obviously trumps me.
There you have it. Star maker Kenny Bolin with a guest run-in from James E. Cornette.
What the fuck? I can't even call this fucking clown on the goddamn phone now, and so without being... It's like talking to the CIA around here.
It makes it so much funnier considering he actually called you at the beginning of this show and it just all worked out perfect.
Well, I was afraid if he dies, I got nobody to dupe my DVDs. So,
well, Jim, we've done this before with you during your previous appearances here on 605, the Super Podcast. We're going to try this again. We have two different videos. In the past, we watched El Pibe Diaz with you. We watched Rock and Roll Roy Toy with you. Both very popular videos and very popular segments with our listeners. Now we want to watch a couple things, one which we've talked about previously here on the show, and one which we've never had on the show, maybe a future candidate in our Super Universe Top 10. So we've sent you a couple links, Bix has sent you a couple links, and right now we want to watch with you The Patriot versus Coco Ware from February 1st, 1986 in the WMC-TV studios in Memphis.
All right, do you have the link?
I am ready. I'm ready to press play.
All right, well, let me press play.
Oh, you can press play. Well,
yes,
good.
We can all press play. That's what's nice about syncing it up.
And just tell us what you see. There's the Patriot, and obviously a bootleg Patriot.
Well, yeah, it's not really Del Wilkes. There's Coco in that beautiful K&H special jacket he's got there.
Now, keep an eye on Coco before the match starts. I mean, keep an eye on him the whole time, but notice.
Wait a minute. I'm trying to figure out who the Patriot is.
Well, watch what happens to this patriot here.
I wish they'd put some colored lights in the background. I can barely see Coco. They used to have those nice red color lights. Oh my Jesus Christ, that's horrible.
Watch.
The patriot is trying to get away from...
Coco just knocked him out.
Coco didn't knock him out. He knocked himself out when he didn't know to tuck his chin when he took his flat back bump on the ring. And now the guy's trying to figure out which way is up so he can get there. He's going to be walking recklessly and attempting to fall. Coco, I have no idea why he is probably just fed up with this fucking guy. Because he ain't giving him any time to recuperate.
Keep in mind, he's the baby face.
You know what? It appears, good God, Coco was strong as a bull. Be able to get that weight up.
Watch closely, Jimmy, watch as he pins him.
Bix, let me talk. Watch the finisher, Jimmy. Boom. So we've been trying to figure out who this guy is and why.
Okay.
This happened.
Well, I'm going to read between the lines, and I'm going to say that this guy came into the locker room and offended Coco in some way, possibly the old, yeah, brother, we'll have a great match. I've been doing this for 6 years or whatever type of deal, and didn't want to listen, or offended him in some other kind of way that he decided, I'm just going to go and beat this guy up. But in the process, when he started trying to do whatever the fuck he was doing, the guy was so fucking dish raggy that he couldn't even get that out of it. And then he hit him with a nice clothesline, but it shouldn't have knocked him out. But the guy knocked himself out because he didn't know how to take a fucking bump. And then Coco was really disgusted because now we can't even have a fucking match. So fuck it. And he just kicked the shit out of him in a working way. But as you notice, he protected him on the Ghostbuster there, as he called his Brainbuster. So he wasn't shooting, trying to hurt him. He just didn't give a fuck whether he potatoed him or not.
That's right. That's right. Well, that one has been very popular here on the show. The Patriot was a former contender for the top 10, although he was voted off. And now we're going to show you a new video, a video that may become a sensation here on the show. And this video is the second link we have sent you, Jim, which you can click.
Okay, hold on. I got to get back there. Okay, I'm getting that up. And I'm joining that. And there we go. Oh, my God. My old friend, Ken Patera.
And no one's old friend, Judo Joe Black, who this is the only match I've seen of Judo Joe, and I would love to know what you think.
And Bobby the Brain is with Ken Patera.
That's right. So let's press play on this video now. You don't see too many wrestlers in karate gis past 1978.
Bobby looks fantastic. The black sequin jacket, the wide lapelled red silk shirt.
I mean, he looks so good, Patera kissed him on the forehead. He did.
Old Judo Joe, he looks like Eric Bischoff from the hard camera shot from a distance with his fluffy hair. And they're going to lock up now. And Judo Joe don't have a fucking clue how to work. He's probably never had but three matches in his life, if that. I can tell that by the lockup. He is completely lost now that he's in a front face lock. But he gets up with a lot of spring in his step. He gets up off the mat well. He has no idea how to fucking lock up. He doesn't know how to be taken in an arm wringer. He did a flip, but he can't remember which way to go. Okay, he's seen this shit on TV. That's what it is. He's seen this shit on TV. So he knew how to do that flip and that roll up.
Tara just controlling him.
Can the listeners hear the audio to this?
No, they can't.
On our show? Oh,
when
I wish
they could. If we make a video of it, they will.
Oh, my God. Patera tries to spring him, sling him off the top. And, oh, my God. And he doesn't. He goes down face first, and he gives him a turnbuckle, and he takes a phony bump face first.
Twice.
And the people are scoff laughing now. Patera is now mad because the fans are laughing at his match. So he slammed him halfway across the fucking ring, but still safely. The fans are booing and not in a good way now. And he picks old Judo up, and he's supposed to be setting him on the top turnbuckle, but Joe Black don't know how to get there. So now he says, oh, fuck it. He slams him off the top.
He has not moved.
Drops a nice elbow. Probably that was pretty stiff. Three. There we go.
And
that was brutal.
Judo Joe Black. If anyone knows anything else about him, let us know.
That I don't know. I don't know why that they let the guy come into the ring with a gimmick like that when nobody had ever heard of him and he obviously didn't know what the fuck he was doing. That may have been the Chief J Strongbow era of booking the job guys.
Well, this was Poughkeepsie, so it may just have been. Well,
they could have just had Joe fucking Black or whatever the fuck instead of Judo Joe. I can't believe Joe they Mitchell? Let a dad come in with a gimmick.
Well, you can cut the tape now, Bix.
Yeah, the tape, Bix. They should have burned the tape.
I do want to ask you something, Jimmy, because we recently talked about here on the show with John Arezzi again, the famed photo of Buddy Rogers with Bruno Sammartino shaking hands, which was a real coup at the time because they hated each other. They didn't want to be in a room with each other. And Georgie Ann Macropoulos was the one who was able to get them together because she had been the president of both of their fan clubs back in the days. I've heard you tell this story before. I'd love for you to tell it on the air because to me, it's one of the most fascinating things that isn't really out there. And what's the story behind Georgie Ann Macropoulos' role in Bruno Sammartino winning the WWF championship and also Buddy Rogers leaving the territory?
Well, once again, the way I heard it, wrestling lore has become that because Georgie Ann was one of the, in the 50s is when fan clubs first came around, and then they were dormant for a while after the national TV, and they only had the main ones, and then they came back again in the 70s with the magazine columns you would see. But Georgie Ann was one of the early of the modern era fan club presidents. She's usually a female in some major market that a lot of the guys worked. And she was also one of the early, you know, kibitzers that was able to get inside because everybody loved Georgie Ann and did, you know, till she passed away. But so apparently not only was she Bruno's fan club president and at one time Buddy Rogers fan club president, but that's when, you know, Rogers and his wife lived there and Bruno, the guys lived in the area. So she was apparently over at Rogers's house one day and heard something from his wife to the indication that Rogers was planning on figuring out some way. He already had some of his crew in. He always liked to bring in his guys, the guys he liked to work with and against, and have the crew beholden to him for their job so that he could control the booking and possibly, you know, get a piece of the promotion or get paid like a partner for the time he's there or whatever the fuck. So anyway, he was the champion. He was plotting to take over Vince's territory, or at least pull a power play that would get him a lot more fucking money and et cetera, et cetera. And Georgie Ann, as Reggie B. Fine once said on Memphis TV, delayed the information back over to Bruno, who then told Vince Sr., who then put the kibosh on that, and that was during Bruno's ascension to the belt. And once again, it's wrestling lore, but one would think that things like that used to happen and certainly was within the realm of possibility.
Yeah, I had heard that before, too, and you're the only person I've ever heard actually say it. Like, when Meltzer does a history of the WWF, he never writes about that, and that's such a key part of wrestling history.
Well, maybe he didn't want to bury Georgie Ann as being a stooge.
Oh, well, you know, it could be that. I guess that could be a way of putting it. I know you have to go, Jim. I know you're tight on time, but I want to thank you once again for appearing on the show.
I wasn't tight on time before this fucking miniseries started.
Hey, and this is going to be one of our shorter episodes. So
well, Steve, we over at the Experience, we try to keep the show short because I'm not that entertaining. But you have so many more bells and whistles over here.
That's right.
Because you guys got a bigger budget because because we're over on MLW and I cashed a check from Cord Bauer one time and the bank bounced. So we got no budget over there. But if the folks want to hear even more of you, if that's possible, they can obviously hear you every week on the Jim Cornette Experience, where you co-hostify my little program, and we're over on MLWRadio.com with the peasants.
That's right, and you can hear me there. Now I don't have to plug it at the end. This is really nice the way this works.
But and we don't have a good producer like you got to plays all the tapes, does all the stuff. Styles Bitchley, he's coasting on his former glory. You know, when he used to hang out with Phil Spector and that crowd. He didn't make the wall of sound. He made the mound of sound. So anyway, thank you for having me on the Super Podcast. It's been super. I've enjoyed my time here, and I bid you a good day.
And we'll be right back after this short transition music. Well, there's our nice little transition music. Some of you may recognize where it's from. We'll see if anyone posts anything on Twitter or Facebook, Bix, facebook.com/superpodcast, saying that they know exactly where it's from. What are the lyrics to it, by the way? Let's see if anyone gets the lyrics. I know Bix knows them, and right now Bix is fighting every urge he has to sing them on the air because he's also gotten them stuck in my head. But we'll see if anyone says anything. A few things. Obviously, thank you, Jim Cornette, for coming on again. He will be on again in a little while. Maybe not in the next month, but we have a bunch of stuff we didn't get to today that we still want to get to with Jim. So we will have him back on pretty soon. And I want to say, you know, Jim didn't know we were going to have the Dentist of the Week with Kenny. We kind of sprung that on him. Jim also obviously didn't know that we were recording with Kenny when he called Kenny. And that's all here on the show. So that's pretty crazy. We ended up cutting the tape just because we weren't sure how much further that conversation was going to go. So that's why there's an abrupt ending to the Kenny segment where, you know, the phone, he's on the phone with Jim and then we cut it right there. It went a little further, nothing any more crazy or interesting than what was on the air, but you'll hear more from Kenny next week on the show. We're going to have a long segment with Kenny Bolin. I will dare say it is the best thing he's ever done on a wrestling podcast. We're going to hear about the origins of Kenny in wrestling, all the fun times he had with Jim as a wrestling fan, trying to watch wrestling from different cities, trying to tape wrestling, getting involved with Nick Gulas, all sorts of great stuff. Like I said, I feel confident in saying it's the best thing Kenny Bolin's ever done on a wrestling podcast. So we have it here next week on the show. We'll also have a little bit more with Kenny about Dennis, just tying everything together because of that wacky ending you heard to the Dennis of the Week segment this week. And that will be coming up pretty soon. Also next week on the show, part two of our discussion about wrestling families. I know so many of you have written to me and Bix and said, you forgot the Armstrongs, you forgot the Cormiers, you forgot this one and that one. No, we didn't. We expected to have a half hour segment that went an hour. And we knew if we added more names to it, it would go 2 hours. So with that said, part two next week here on the Super Podcast, mixed in with all the usual schmas and all the usual jazz. And we'll have follow-ups next week and lots of other stuff. Jim was on the show today. And for those of you who don't know, Jim was also a part of a recent column, a really great column that Bix did about wrestling hotlines. And Bix, as we go to plugs, I think you should start with this because you did a great job with it. Tell us a little bit about this article.
Thank you. It is in Kernel Magazine at Daily Dot, which is Kernel, K-E-R-N-E-L, mag.daily.com. As we post this, it is the latest issue. I'm sure they have archives. I'm not exactly sure how it's laid out because I haven't bothered to check. But it's the week this went up, so it would be the – let's see, what is today's date? So it would have been the – May 15th, 2016 issue of The Kernel, and it's about kind of the history of wrestling hotlines, sort of, and various different things about the hotlines. I talked to Jim Cornette, Steve Beverly, Lance Russell, and also Dominic Valenti and his hotline, which still exists, the Wrestling Hot Seat, and the number is in there, so everyone can call it. There is a SoundCloud of one from a couple months ago, because this was originally going to be in the WrestleMania issue, and it got delayed to...
I listened to that. It is fucking ridiculous. Obviously, you taped it. Did you listen to the actual recording?
I believe I did when I was recording it, yes.
He was never as filthy back in the 90s as he is now, because I forget who it was. There's someone on TNA. Let's just call her Becky, just to give a name that's in the news because of Beyonce. He's like, and then Becky comes out with her big old titties. I'm like, well, what? Dominic was never like that back in the day. He was very much not saying anything over the top. So it's interesting to see where he's gone in his old age, my old friend.
Was it Rebel?
Maybe it was Rebel. Maybe it was Rebel. I don't know. I really don't know who any of these people are, so I don't know.
But yes, a fun article there. Lots of stuff. Cornette steals the show with his line, I have to say.
Of course.
I won't spoil it, though. I don't think I should. Everyone go read the article. But it relates to the staying power of how wrestling and phone sex outlasted all the other hotlines.
You just fucking gave away the house. You said, I'm not going to do it. And then, I mean.
No, because that was actually a question I asked him. So I did not realize I would get such a good line.
Okay. Fair enough.
And otherwise, I would not have given that much detail. Trust me. That's That's to get people to read the article.
Well, it's a really neat article. Best article Bix has had since the Big Show article, although all the things he writes are really good. But a really good article. I think a lot of you guys would really, if not all of you, would really get a kick out of it. It's a little covered topic in wrestling history, the wrestling hotlines, whether it was the WCW 900 number or whether it was a free hotline like Dominic Valente. So please do check that out. Bix, give the link one more time.
ColonelMag.daily.com. And I also have some other stuff coming up soon. Next month's Fighting Spirit magazine, I have an interview with Mick Foley commemorating kind of the 20th anniversary of King of the Ring 96 and his big win over Undertaker, to as kind of a springboard to talk about leaving ECW for WWF, the first year of his WWF run, working with The Undertaker, that sort of stuff. And that was really cool to do, and it came out real well. So that's coming out in the issue that comes out next month.
Very cool. Do you have anything else you want to plug this week, Bix?
Yeah, of course, as always, a new episode of Between the Sheets with me and Chris Elner. We had a guest scheduled. He had to reschedule, so it's just me and Chris talking about This Week in History in 1990, with the two big stories of the week being Ole Anderson, your good friend, being hired as WCW's head booker, and Misawa unmasking in All Japan, taking off the Tiger Mask 2 mask as the beginning of his big run there as the top babyface. So lots of other stuff besides that, but those are the two big stories that week. Two very different stories from two very different parts of the wrestling world. And of course, that is on the PWO-PTBN podcast network.
PWO/every letter of the alphabet podcast network. Bix, before we go any further, obviously we have the show plugs now, but once again, give us the information about the RSS feeds.
Okay. So obviously, if you're using an Apple device, iPad, iPhone, your Mac, you're probably, or at least most likely, using either iTunes or the podcast's app to listen to this. Maybe you have something else you like better. A lot of other apps, they might have a directory that has us listed. If they do, great, subscribe through that. But a lot of them don't, and we figured there should be an easier way to subscribe. So the way to do that is, when you subscribe manually, it asks for a feed URL. We made it much easier, because now you can just type in 605feed.com, and that'll subscribe you. It's that simple. You don't have to remember anything about feed burner or anything like that. So that's 605feed.com. Of course, subscribe on that. Subscribe on iTunes, whatever you want. Please subscribe if you're listening. It's helpful if you're subscribing. And yeah, I guess that's it as far as that.
And speaking of iTunes, let me just say, not only does it help if you subscribe on there, but it helps us if you leave a review, a 5-star review, like your favorite matches, like El Pibe Diaz, like the Patriot versus Coco Beware, or actually Coco Ware. He wasn't B yet. He didn't pick up his middle initial. You can go to iTunes and leave us a review. This week's 5-star review of the week is from the Poist. This already cracked me up. The Postcoital Larry Nelson. The best tag team in the business. Until recently, I'd been led to believe by family and friends that wrestling was fake. Match outcomes prearranged. Cleverly disguised ketchup packets depicted as forehead wounds, etc. It wasn't until I overheard this podcast while sitting uncomfortably in Dark Journey's waiting room that I learned the truth. Wrestling is realer than real life. A stranger truth than fiction. With thrilling characters galore and puns for days. With big-hearted insight and remarkable dedication, Brian and Bix offer an inside look at an industry so fun and surprising, you won't even mind that it murdered your dog. Thanks, 605. Santo Gold, Santo Gold. So, join Poist. I keep saying Poist. Join Postcoital Larry Nelson and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. It would really, really help us, as well as subscribing on iTunes. Hey, we mentioned it previously earlier in the show briefly. tinyurl.com/605Amazon. You can get anything you need from Amazon that you would normally get. It's just by using our referral link, we get a small cut. It's a way of supporting the show without having to actually spend any money on the show. Just do what you would normally do at Amazon, and we get a cut. Perhaps you're interested in buying denim. Why not? We have Denim Fritz on the show every week. We should do denim as the item to buy of the week. You can go to Amazon. Yeah, get whatever you need. Get a denim jacket. Get a denim mask. buy denim and make something else out of it. Who knows? They got it all up there. Amazon, who knows how this business model works? I don't even think they're turning a profit, but they got lots of people using it just like you. So please, tinyurl.com/605Amazon. Bix, what are the links for the international listeners as well as for the bounties we currently have available?
Okay, for international listeners, these are the ones we have set up because they're English-speaking countries that have Amazon referral links, and it's UK and Ireland, tinyurl.com/605AmazonUK. Canada is tinyurl.com/605AmazonCA. And, of course, buy raw denim or whatever Brian wants you to buy there, or denim clothing, whatever. And we also have two bounties, as Amazon calls them.
Raw denim. That's like if Fritz had a Monday night show. Raw denim.
Okay. The bounties that Amazon calls them, which are for trials of two of the subscription services that they offer. For Amazon Prime, it's tinyurl.com/605Prime. Amazon Prime is, of course, Amazon's catch-all subscription service, which includes free two-day shipping on everything shipped and sold by Amazon.com, which means third-party sellers only if it's fulfilled by Amazon. Unlimited streaming, their own version of Netflix, including a bunch of original shows, discounts on pre-ordering video games, their lending library, maybe forgetting one or two things. Oh, and also cheaper overnight shipping, too. That's tinyurl.com/605Prime. As long as you do the 30-day free trial, you can even cancel it right away. We get our little kickback. So even if you don't think you'll use it going forward, you can just sign up, then cancel, and we still get our little kickback. Kindle Unlimited is the other one, which is tinyurl.com/605Kindle. That is kind of like their Netflix for ebooks. Same deal, 30-day free trial. You could cancel the trial, and we still get our kickback. You can, you know, even without using it, you could just use it for an hour or whatever, or not use it, and then cancel, and we still get our thing. So that's tinyurl.com/605Prime and tinyurl.com/605Kindle.
And remember, you could check out Kenny Boland's book available on Kindle Unlimited. So try it out for 30 days just to read that because it's a very entertaining book. And again, thank you, Kenny, for being on the show this week. You know, those are the bounties. And speaking of bounties, I remember when Flair had a bounty on my boy Kerry. Well, tinyurl.com/605Amazon. Just remember one last thing, everyone. Fuck those guys. Don't support anyone else's link. Big show or small show, it doesn't matter. Support the Super Podcast because this is the best wrestling podcast out there. Trust me, we spend way too much time on it. It has to be. Well, speaking of ways to help out the show, there's a donation tab at the bottom of each page on the 605 pod.com. Every single post you'll see, you could donate to David, you could donate to Brian. If you want to donate to us and have it be split, just notate that you want it split, but you could also donate to either one of us depending on how you like the show. And a lot of people have asked. There will be a Patreon page that I'm going to be setting up in the next few weeks. So if you want to just support the show on an ongoing basis, there will be the option there. And by the way, thank you for everyone who has said that you would support a Patreon. I haven't even asked that. People have said if there was one, I would use it. So there will be one soon. And thank you for everyone. Thank you, everyone, for all the support you guys have given us time after time after time. As I mentioned last week, there is now a P.O. box if you want to actually send anything into the show, whether it's a video, a magazine, a letter. I don't know. I don't know what you people, Frankie the Bird. I don't know what fits in a box nowadays. And that is P.O. Box 1242, Morristown, New Jersey, 07962. Again, that's P.O. Box 1242. Morristown, New Jersey, 07962. Anything you need to send into the show, that is the official show address. On Twitter, he's at David Bix. I'm at Great Brian Last, and the show is at 605Pod. And you can always use the hashtag 605Pod to join in the conversation and let us know what you think. And of course, my favorite thing about the show, our growing community on Facebook, facebook.com/superpodcast. The numbers just keep going up. It's still just a fraction of our listening audience, but it's the most active members of our audience. And each week we put up the show link first there at midnight on Thursday. We put up the video playlist every Friday afternoon to where you can vote for the top 10 and usually the top 10 runoffs. We have various pictures and videos and all sorts of fun stuff that go up there. Whenever we want to know what the listeners think about a certain thing, we usually ask on there and get everyone's response. So facebook.com/superpodcast. Please join our community. Let us know what you think. It is also the best way to directly get in touch with the show beyond sending a message on Twitter to Bix or myself. You can send a message to the Facebook page and it will be received, and we will definitely acknowledge it and let you know what we think. So beyond that, Bix, I think we've gotten through all the plugs.
I think we did. What else would there be?
I think we did. I think we actually did. I'm so amazed that it actually happened that I don't even know what to do now. But anyway, next week on the show, more from Kenny Bolin. Like I said, the best radio or podcast interview Kenny Bolin's ever done. You'll get the story of the origins of Kenny Bolin, and I think everyone will really, really enjoy it. It was fun. I know some of you think Kenny does a little too much shtick or anything. First of all, I could tell you, he doesn't. That's Bix, back me up on this. That's actually just the way he is. Kenny, when you think you're hearing Kenny and he's doing shtick with Cornette, you heard the tape earlier today. You heard the phone call. That's legit. That's the actual way they speak to each other. So Kenny's not doing that. But next week, I think you're going to get a lot of insight from Kenny about his early days in wrestling. And he's very honest. And it's not as over the top as some of the other things Kenny's done, but it's fantastic. And we really look forward to having Kenny back on next week, as well as more with Wrestling Families talk next week here on the show. So until next week, he's David Bixenspan. I am the great Brian Last. Tally-ho!
Cornette of the Midnight Express also talking about Christmas.
Mark Lawrence, I've heard so much about Texas, and now that we're finally here, I'm all choked up. You know, I understand we're here in the Will Rogers Complex, is that right?
That's right.
Will Rogers, the man who's famous for the words, "I never met a man I didn't like." You never met me, Will Rogers, because I got about as much in common with a tobacco-chewing, dust-kicking redneck that wears cowboy boots and a cowboy hat as I do with a Martian with three heads. But I tell you what I do have the greatest tag team in the entire world, the greatest combination in sports, lean, mean, slick and quick, the skill, the strength, the stamina, and the ability of two men blended together as one, twin sons of different mothers. Every thought, every action is combined as a team. And that's exactly why that on Christmas night, we got that big American tag team title match coming up with the Fantastics, Bobby Fulton and Tommy Rogers. I'll go ahead and call them the Valley Girls, Muffy and Sissy, because that's what I think of them. They come out here wearing these rock and roll outfits and these tuxedos and playing all this music, and all those girls line the arenas and line the aisles to come out and greet them, and the smell of cheap perfume congregated by all those prepubescent little females makes me sick to my stomach. Now, we've known Bobby Fulton and Tommy Rogers a time or two before, and they've got an extra couple of dents in their head because of it, and all I've got to say is, every place that we have ever seen them, they've been the first ones to leave, if you know what I'm saying, because they don't want none of the baddest tag team in wrestling.